apologies, briefing by the Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment Commission on its annual performance grant for 2018-19. Then there's a T, and I think that we should make that a working T. I don't think we need to break the T.
And then the last item on the agenda is the follow-up engagement with the DTI on the 2018-19 annual performance plan. So can I have a mover and a support? Thank you. We'll move straight away into apologies. If the Secretary could tell us what apologies there are.
Good morning. The Chairperson is on an international business. Mr. Kachalia is also on party business. Ms. Mantash at attending classes. Advocate Albert is on party business. And Ms. Teko will leave soon after we start. Thanks.
There you have it. So we'll move right along to the briefing by the Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment Commission. So I'm going to hand over to the Commission to introduce whoever they have brought with them, and then they can move straight into their presentation. Thank you.
Good morning, honourable members. Thank you, Chairperson, as well, for the opportunity to present to the Portfolio Committee today. We're just going to start quickly with the introductions, and we're very happy today that we've got our Director General with us today during this presentation. So we'll just do a quick round of introductions on this side, and then we'll then commence with the presentation. My name is Zodwan Duli, the Commissioner for the BBBEE Commission.
Good morning, Chairperson, honourable members. It's Busen Gwenya, BBBEE Commission.
Morning, Chair and honourable members. Liso Seto, BEE Policy Unit, DTI.
Morning, Chair. Morning, honourable members. DG Commissioner, committee members, fellow members from the, or colleagues from the DTI. My name is Joseph Melody, from the Enforcement and Investigation BU Commission. Thank you.
Lionel October, DG of DTI.
Morning, Honorable Members. Ndombi Matomela, SDG, CEO of the DTI.
Sorry, Chair. We're just battling with the, with the mic today. All right. Chair, again, thank you again for the opportunity. I think the last time that we were here in this committee, we were very fresh, and certainly at the time we were telling you what our plans are going to be. Today we do also have an opportunity that although we're going to present to you our strategy, but we'll also be telling you what is it that we've done so far so that you can also see clarity on some of the activities that we've done so that we can test in terms of the strategy going forward whether these activities will still align with our strategy. And so we do thank you for this opportunity, especially because it comes this early in the year, and we can also adjust some of the plans that we have and the activities specifically to align with what the inputs of the members would be today if there is direction that we need to take that is different from what we're thinking. Chair, we have submitted our presentation to yourself. So in terms of the documents that we forwarded to the committee through Saroj, it is our presentation. And we also have submitted to you a list of cases that the commission has initiated on its own. And on the side of the column of that document, we have also indicated to you just the progress on those cases that are initiated proactively by the commission. But we've also submitted to you a list of cases where we have issued notices of investigation. What we mean by notice of non-investigation is that the matter may actually be very well a matter that falls within our mandate, but we do not have jurisdiction because of the time period. You find that is an old matter. It happened before the Act, the amendments to the Act came into effect. And some of the non-investigations are purely on the basis that you find that it's a matter where it's a contractual dispute that does not relate to any fronting or anything of that sort. So we've provided you with a list of that. And during our presentation, we will then refer to some of the findings that we've made, but without necessarily specifying the various entities that we have been investigating. So if from the list that the committee members has, there's a specific question in relation to any particular investigation, we can then elaborate on that depending on what the issues that the committee wants to understand are. So, Chair, we will follow our presentation, and in the interest of time, while we skip some of the slides, we will still be in a position to take questions on that, but we'll try as much as possible to cover everything. So the presentation today is going to be delivered to you by myself and my colleague, Busingwenya, and then we will then all take up the questions and clarification when we get to that point. So when we came to this committee, we did provide a basis for our existence by giving the background in terms of why the BBB Commission exists. In the wisdom of Parliament, it amended the BBB legislation in 2013, particularly to create an oversight body to monitor the implementation of BBB so that the objectives that were intended can actually be achieved. Previously, there wasn't a body of that sort, so everybody implemented BBB legislation in the manner that they think is appropriate, and which often was not the case. So with our existence at this point, the hope of everybody else, I think, in the country is that going forward, then we'll find the BBBE deals that are going to really benefit black people, that are going to empower black people in terms of ownership, but over and above, cover all of the other elements of BBBE, which is management control, skills development, enterprise and supply development, as well as socio-economic development. So our job is to make sure that we monitor the implementation so that we are able to advance those objectives that were intended. So in then looking at our mandate in terms of the legislation, we went and said, as an institution, what is it that we want to be doing? What is our mission? What is our vision? And our vision is projected there on the slide. Basically, our mission recognizes the need for acceleration. And this arises from the point that if you look back from 2003, if we had a monitor for the implementation of BBBE, the country would have been a bit far by now. In a sense that at least things would have happened the right way perhaps from the beginning. So we've lost a decade basically in the space of BBBE. Yes, there are some deals, there are some BE initiatives that have gone a long way to assist, but the majority of the initiatives in BBBE have not really given sustainable benefits for the country as was intended. So if you look at our mission then, facilitating the accelerated productive implementation of the legislation is what we are currently doing. And we will then share with you as we present to you what our plan is in terms of how we see that happening. So as I've indicated, our mandate is outlined in Section 13F of the legislation that comes with the amendments in 2013. It wasn't there before. So the creation of the institution was included in the amendments, and the functions are outlined there. I'm not going to touch on all of them, but I'm going to indicate the ones that are critical and that actually were the reason why these amendments were introduced. As I indicated, there is a need to oversee. So we've got a broad mandate in 13F1A where we oversee the market, and when we pick up things that are anomalies, we are able then to intervene. For instance, if we read in the papers that there may be a BBBE deal that has not gone right or that is not being implemented correctly, through this provision, we are able to write to the entity and even go on a site visit to inspect and be able to come out with a report and then make recommendations to the entity in terms of what it is that they should change. And that is a process outside an investigation. And we use this provision, Chair, to, as we say, to monitor the activities in the market. For instance, when we pick up fraudulent certificates or BBB certificates that don't look proper, then we act on those outside an investigation, and we are able to then get the conduct to be corrected immediately through that process. But also, as I indicated, that we are also able to do site visits through this. And I think as Busi does the presentation, she'll also give you some of the examples where we've done site visits and we are shocked at what we find at the premises of the entities that on paper, on their website, look so legit and look like they are real activities. But when you get there, what is written on their websites, what is written on their profiles, you do not find on the ground. So where they've said that the company is black-owned or 51% black-owned, you get there, there's absolutely nothing that you find that resembles the blackness that they claim on their websites and so forth. So the site visits, we are able to do them under this provision around the general oversight function. Then the other important function is for the Commission to receive complaints, but also to initiate complaints on its own accord where it finds that there are instances where violations are suspected. So we will then give you also a report on the statistics of what we've done so far and some of the results that we've already indicated. But Chair, I think I must pause just at this point and explain to you what the legislation says about our investigations. And I think at some point it becomes a bit frustrating for members of the public when the Commission says we cannot comment to you about this investigation until we've published our findings. It's because the legislation, the BBB legislation, is structured like this. So where we are initiating an investigation or where we receive a complaint, then we decide to investigate. Once we have investigated, where we have found something, whether it's adverse or not adverse, we need to give the respondent company an opportunity of 30 days to respond to our findings. During that 30 days, the entity may provide additional information which the Commission is obliged to consider further before it makes its final findings. So once we have considered the responses within the timeline of the entities, then we do the assessment and then we do our final findings. Once we've made those final findings, we're not allowed to publish them up until we allow an opportunity for the respondent company to indicate whether they're taking us to court or not on review if they don't agree with our findings. So at all times, we've got to follow that process. That's what the legislation says. So up until we have actually published them formally in that way, we cannot speak about the content, because then when we speak about that content, it means we are publishing in a way. So publication would mean if we speak about it here and it gets to be captured by the media, then we have published. So we have actually contravened our own processes as the Commission. So that is the frustration that we face as the Commission, where you find that we are not publishing the findings yet because we're still waiting for that time period to lapse up until we can then publish formally what the findings are. And the other thing that is also a complication is that where we have made a recommendation in our findings for the entity to be referred for criminal prosecution, we cannot publish the content of our findings up until the NPA has made a decision to prosecute. So there are a number of dependencies in terms of the work that we are doing, which we think over a period of time, I think it would be a process that we'll propose to the department to say these are some of the things that we might have to change just to make sure that the work of the Commission is not restrained by these kinds of provisions that are tying up, which are not necessarily common to the other regulators like your NCR, the Competition Commission, because once they've made the decision, they can actually speak about the decision, because talking about the decision is not only about punishing, but it's about raising some of the issues that are not supposed to happen so that it can also be educational for the other parties not to do that. So at this point, we are a bit restrained in terms of just communicating some of the findings immediately after finalizing them. So we're hoping that as we take you through this and through this process, we will be able to give you some of the examples of the findings that we've made. And again, members, as we've said, if there's any specific matter in the list that we've provided that you'd like us to elaborate, and we will be able to do that, but within the limits of the provisions that I've already provided. Chair, there's also two other functions, as I've indicated, that are important. That is the third one for us would be, after the investigations, it will be the requirement to register major BBB transactions. So the minister issued the threshold for what is going to be considered to be major, because a number of people would really argue what major is, and we believe that at the moment the threshold that has been set by the minister is a reasonable threshold. So minister set the threshold of a transaction value of 25 million. So every BBB transaction that occurs in this country that falls within that threshold must then be registered with the BBB Commission. There are specific documents that we require for that registration, which would include the sale of shares agreements, the financing agreement, all the subscriptions agreement, the pledges, all of the other documents that are relating to that transaction. So once we receive it, our job is then to assess that transaction for compliance with the legislation. So in terms of the Act, we've got a period of 90 days to go back to the parties to indicate to them if we are finding any problem with that particular transaction. And as we present again, Busi will share with you some of the things, because we've already assessed a number of transactions and we've already given feedback to a number of entities in terms of the areas that are non-compliant with the legislation. And then the last part that I wanted to talk to in terms of our function, Chair, is the requirement for JSE-listed companies, the CETAs, as well as organs of state, which includes public entities, to submit annual reports to the Commission on how they are doing against the five elements that I've already alluded to. So this is a compulsory requirement, and we started receiving, obviously, the reports from last year, and we will then give you an indication of the statistics in terms of how we're doing with that. And we've already written to this committee to request their intervention in regards to encouraging and actually holding government departments to actually account in terms of why they're not submitting their compliance reports. I think one of the things that becomes particularly difficult for a regulator is when government itself is not respecting its own rules, because we cannot expect to chase other people in the private sector when government itself does not do its part. So we are appealing also to the committee to actually just hold them accountable when they come to report here to make sure that some of those things are done. But we'll give you the statistics in terms of how we've received that. So, Chair, one of the things that made the reporting and the registration of deals to become part of the amendments was the fact that we, as a country, we didn't have data on how BBBE is actually progressing in the country. So we didn't have any data to measure how we're doing. And this presents an opportunity now to have data that is based on company reports that are audited by their auditors as well, but also verified when it comes to the Commission. When they report, we also analyze that information and also verify it and go back to the companies to make sure that we've got at least data that can be relied upon. So going forward, on an annual basis, the Commission will publish a report that then will be based on those submissions that are made to the Commission on an annual basis. So hopefully then we can be able to get at least stats that everybody else can speak from going forward. In terms of just our priority elements, we have outlined our priority elements, and you'll see as we then go into the presentations in the table, under each aspect we'll explain what is it that we're going to be doing. But our priority elements are linked directly to what our mandate is. Chair, I must also just go back to just also, because I know that as we speak, sometimes we'll refer to QSEs, we'll refer to EMEs. We just need to explain them those categories immediately, so that then we make the committee understand what we're talking about on those issues. So in terms of the categorization of companies for purpose of BBBE, we've got three categories. We've got EMEs, which are exempted micro-enterprises. Exempted micro-enterprises are those enterprises that have got an annual turnover of less than 10 million. So any entity that has an annual turnover of less than 10 million will be an EME, an exempted micro-enterprise. Then we've got a qualifying small enterprise. Qualifying small enterprise is an entity that's got an annual turnover of between 10 million and 50 million. And the every entity above 50 million will then be a generic entity. So that's a big entity. So now the reason why we have this categorization is because if you're an EME, then there are certain things that you're not required to comply with within the triple BEE. One of them is that if you're an EME, less than 10 million, you are not required to get yourself verified by a verification professional or a verification agency. So that was a deliberate intervention that government felt was necessary to make sure that we do not add to the cost of doing business for smaller entities. So those small entities have got automatic levels starting from level 1 to level 4. So if you're 100% black owned and you are in EME, then you've obviously got an automatic level 1. So, but if you're not having the black ownership, for instance, you're just a pure white owned entity but you're an EME, you still are entitled to an automatic level 4. So it just assists to make things simpler and easier for the smaller entities. Then when you get into the QSE category, if you're between 10 million and 50 million, then there's a level at which you are required and you are obliged to do a verification, because now you are required to do all of the elements in terms of skills development, enterprise development, all of those things which must be measured. All right. So that is the real distinction. So as we speak about that, if we can keep on remembering what we mean by that. And just in terms of our strategy, Chair, when we looked at our mandate, we realized that the main thing is for the Commission to assist this country to achieve what triple BEE legislation was intended to achieve. So if we look at the objectives of the Act hinges, the objectives hinge on changing the ownership patterns of this country and making sure that black people do ultimately own productive assets. So we're talking real ownership here. So one of the things that people would argue is that, you know, passive ownership probably is not really giving people real black ownership. But I think the interventions of government are actually integrated in that form, where you can have passive ownership, which means that you're acquiring equity in existing entities that are already in the market. But also, programs of government like the Black Industrialist now want for the black people to actually create new markets for themselves. So we're expanding the pie as opposed to just allowing people to just enter into an existing pie, because the pie is not too big. So facilitating the expansion of that pie is happening through the black industry. So when you look at some of these programs, they actually wanting to advance the changing of the ownership patterns. And then we then look at the issue around skills development, which is very critical as well in the objectives of this legislation. Skills development to make sure that in a sustainable way, we're able to have people that know about the industries. So companies are here required to train people through the skills development 6% amount that is allocated for that. So the training of these people to make sure also that you allow for black people to enter in the industries that where they were precluded before. So it facilitates that. So and then we look at the issues around skills development, which are expanding the pie for funding. Basically, what the enterprise and supply development does, it transforms the supply chain of entities, where you are putting in new suppliers into the supply chain, and it changes basically the database and the vendor list of a lot of entities by compelling them to actually put on a lot more new entrants. But over and above that, what it does is that it offers an opportunity for additional financing, in a sense that in enterprise development, companies are required to even give interest-free loans to new startups so that they can enter into markets. So if these things are done properly, then we should be able to achieve what we want to do. So hence we're saying that when we look at our work and what we were expected to do, the main thing is for the country to achieve what was intended. So our monitoring is to want to make sure that companies are assisted to implement the triple BEE legislation properly to achieve that. So that is why we adopted the compliance-driven strategy, which provides upfront advice to companies upfront assistance for them before they do their initiative, so that we know that the outcome of that initiative is going to meet the objectives of the legislation. Then coupled with that, then we've got the corrective enforcement strategy. The corrective enforcement strategy is intended to deal with those entities that, despite knowing what needs to be done, they are deliberately circumventing the legislation. So we can then correct that behavior through prosecution, but also through other interventions that we can have. So we've got these two strategies that are speaking to each other. So our view is that if our compliance strategy is working very well, then we should see more companies doing the right thing and approaching the commission more for advice upfront. And we'll then see a reduction in the complaints about fronting, because if companies are doing BEE properly, then there shouldn't be really complaints around fronting increasing. So they should actually decrease. So that's how we'll continue to measure it as we go along. So that basically informs our strategy and what our plans are, which hinges on the two strategies that I've already indicated. So in terms of that, we've also organized our work, then our programs, according to our strategy as well. I've already covered the areas which are in our functions, the compliance reports and all of this and the timelines regarding to that. But the part that I have not mentioned, Chair, is the issue around the service that we provide for written clarifications. This is a quick service that we committed to provide within a period of 5 days, because what we picked up is that a lot of companies, when they are busy structuring their initiatives, they would like a response immediately on something that they're not clear about. So this service allows the companies to send an email to us, and then we can then give them a response within 5 days. So far, we're happy to report, Chair, that we are actually meeting that timeline. In fact, most of our clarifications, written clarifications on the interpretation, on the application, are actually done within a period of 3 days. So we're able to give that quick response. Chair, we will then take you through our presentation, and then as we then do that, I'll come back just to wrap up on some of the issues that we believe are strategic, and that as we then implement our strategy, we'll integrate in our implementation. I'll hand over to Ms. Ngwenya to proceed on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner, Chair, and members. Thank you. So we're looking at the first program, which is program one, which is compliance division. With compliance, it's more real about saying how do we guide entities on the implementation of the legislation. And as the commissioner has mentioned, that one of the things that the services that we're offering is advisory opinions, where companies will come to us before they put a structure into place to say, can you look at our transaction or our shareholders agreement or our trust deed, and just give us assurance that it does meet the requirements of the BBBE that we might not found to be in contravention. And for our turnaround times, we give us ourselves 30 days, but in some instances we're able to give feedback in less than that time. But if it's a complex matter, then it might take a little bit longer. But most of them are completed within 30 days. And what we have done is that we've given a report as well for 2016-17 and 17 and 18 to show how many of these we have done. So far we've issued 94 advisory opinions. And then on the written clarifications, we've done 1,603 clarifications. And we've also issued 48 letters in 16-17 on invalid certificates. Now, what you'll find with the BBBE certificate is that some of them, as the commissioner was explaining, the three categories, that you find that they were issued to EMEs. And these entities are only supposed to get sworn affidavits. They were not supposed to be issued with a certificate. So if they hold a certificate, then it makes the certificate invalid. In some instances, what we have found is that an entity would claim to be 51% black-owned, but once you get into that black ownership, you discover that actually it's a sham, it's just a fronting. There's actually no black person there making that certificate again invalid. And when the ERBA, the auditors exited the space, we're only left with SANAS, which was responsible to now accrediting verifiers. But you still found accountants issuing certificates or ERBA auditors issuing certificates, but that will also render those certificates invalid. So that's where we will issue then letters instructing these companies to withdraw those letters. And I must say that 90% of them that we have written to have actually complied, and then some will want to argue, and then that's where we'll then refer them for investigation. For 17-18, we have issued 105 letters. What has now been coming out more and more, Chairperson, is that we're discovering this issue where companies are misrepresenting their blackness, where they've realized that if I'm a QSE, I don't need to be verified, so I can just get a sworn affidavit. And they would claim that they're 51% black-owned. When you go to the CIPC records, you find that there's no black person there. When you ask for shareholder certificate, there's only one white person running that entity. Or they'll set up a supposedly black entity, which is just an opportunistic intermediary, and then use that entity to get tenders. But you find that entity is just a conduit where they get the tenders, but then the money, once it's paid, it goes to the main entity that is the one that's running the company. So those are some of the things that you've been picking up. And then the next one that you said you will do is that you will issue practice guides and practice notes. For instance, when there's an issue that we think it's arising continuously and we need to clarify it. And then these ones we said we'll do two annually, 18-19. So far we've done 7. I know that you have put 4 there, but you've actually done 7. 3 were explanatory notice on how to actually ask for an advisory opinions and to say how, what are the kind of documents you require. And then we issued one as well on the transmerger BBB transactions to say what documents you require, and another one on compliance reports to say what the company should submit. We have also done brochures. You have received some of them from us. So in total, we have now done 5 of those. 2 were on complaints and reports to say how do you report to us, the reporting procedure and complaints procedure. And then we've done one on the EMEs and QSEs. And then we've also done one on frequently asked questions, because there are questions of interpretation that keep coming all the time. And we thought how much easier it is to just compile those and have them in a booklet. So when you come back again, we'll have that published, so that if you've got questions on interpretation, some of the questions have already been answered. You just have that as a referral, but we have it on our website if you're interested to see what it looks like. And then on the issue of the transactions, the commissioner has already mentioned that we have 90 days to assess those. We have received 275 since 9 June last year. And then 85 were rejected for non-compliance. As we mentioned, that we did explanatory notice to say what kind of documents you require from entities. Some of them don't submit these documents. So you say to them, for instance, can you have a shareholders agreement? I mean, that is what you would expect entities to have put in place before the transaction was concluded, and the documents will not be forthcoming. So you wonder how the transaction was concluded, or a trust deed would not be there. And we do give them time. You see that where it says 11 pending. This is where we'll give them time to say, can you please submit this kind of documents, either there's a BE certificate missing or a shoulder agreement missing. If they don't submit those within the prescribed time, then we reject the transaction and say, until you have the documents, please take your documents and resubmit them when you are ready to. We have all the documents that are required. And then we have issued 175 certificates. Those are the transactions that are now registered, where they've submitted all the required documents. And then 75 of these transactions have now been assessed, and 95 of them involved trust. Now, one thing that we're picking up with trust is that almost 100% of this trust have been rejected because they don't meet the rules of trust. Some of them, you find that they've been set up as an education trust. It's not, because with trust, it must be, it's an indirect shareholding, or where you need to know who are the beneficiaries, what is their entitlement, what are they supposed to get. Most of them, you find that they don't even make a provision for your annual, at least one annual general meeting where they will call the beneficiaries in to explain how the trust is performing. Some of them, you find that they don't even mention if there was a loan, how that loan will be paid, when it will be paid. So you don't know whether the trust will ever vest in the black hands. And some of them will find that the entity, let's say it's an employee scheme, the entity will have its directors being the trustees of that scheme, whereas it's quite clear that it says 50% must be representative from the employees, and those employees would not be represented in that particular trust. So those are the challenges that we're picking up. And The major one is around the issue of financing. We're finding that most of them are vendor financed. And you find that a transaction is like maybe worth 400 million, and you wonder how are the employees even going to be able to repay that 400 million, especially when it's not stated that we'll be getting dividends from the entity. So you can see that it could become a perpetual scheme. I think there's one that was in the newspaper where when it was supposed to vest, they decided to say, you know, we don't think this scheme is working very well, and we now want to put a new one in place. So literally, you're just perpetually keeping the trust going because you're getting points as a supposedly black company, but the black people that are supposed to be shoulders in that scheme are not benefiting. So those are some of the challenges that we're seeing with these schemes, and which is why most of them we've actually rejected and require them to amend. But what is also nice is that some that we've written to have actually seen and they've agreed to amend the trust and are waiting for them to resubmit. And one entity actually said to us they would rather not then claim the scheme as a BE scheme than to amend the trust deed. So then we said we'll monitor them to see when they get verified whether they now don't recognize the BE points, because they said they would rather do that than go through the amendment. Now, when we're getting to compliance reports, so far we've received, up until March, we've received 202, we've assessed 190, and then 21 of those were from government departments. But what has happened now, that since we've written a letters of non-compliance to all the government departments and entities, most of them are getting themselves accredited. I think this time next year when we report, the numbers from government will be higher. And also, most of them have asked for presentations so that they can understand what exactly they need to do. So we're thinking that come next year, there'll be a better report as far as government reporting is concerned. Now, moving along to program two, which is our investigations. What you said there is that we do both proactive and reactive. Proactive is where we're talking about initiations. Reactive is when you receive the complaint. And you said on average for 18-19, 80% of those, there should be 80% reports produced on investigations within 12 months. And between 2016-17, 2017-18, we received 334 complaints, and 83 of those were purely on fronting practices. And 35, it was where we initiated or proactively started the investigations. And what so far, 110 investigations have been conducted up until March. And we've issued 63 notices of non-investigation. As the commissioner explained, some of them will be because it was a contractual issue or issues of jurisdiction where a matter happened before 24 October 2014. Some could be labor-related issues. And then we've issued 45 findings. Those are the cases that we have completed, and then we have issued findings to the respondents. And also we've issued 13 summons. Now, what will happen is that at times once we're investigating, because some people say this, there's a conduct that is happening, but you don't have documents. And when you look at what the information that they're giving you, it suggests that you need to dig further. Now, we need to ask for documents at times. So when you do that, the respondent will then at times not want to give the documents or the financial statements. Then the legislation gives us the power to summon the information. That's where the 13 summons have arisen or come from. Now, one of the things that also we have in the regulations is that we can do settlements through alternative dispute resolution, where you realize that the complainant has already suffered enough and you want to give them a redress. So what we can do then is to use the alternative dispute resolution. Joseph will share with some of the cases that we've concluded and just what happened there. So four cases have been resolved through ADR, where complainants then got a redress. And what you also do is that you monitor conditions, because when you do ADR, we also have to put in conditions. For instance, if a black director was not involved in the operations of the company, then you require that they start getting them involved, that they hold proper meetings, because what you find with BBB is that there's a lot of flouting of corporate governance, where companies don't hold meetings, there is no minutes, nothing is recorded. A person will know that today I'm a director, the next thing they've been removed from CIPC without their knowledge. Other times they even forge their signatures to get them removed. Or a person will ask that, can you please now remove me as a director because I don't want to do this anymore. They don't remove them, they just keep them going. So those are some of the challenges that you find where they don't have access to finances. Sometimes they say you are 51% black owner, but you don't have any signing powers. And the person can actually, and that's another thing that we're asking ourselves, the role of the banks. To say, if I'm a 51% black shareholder in a company, but the minority, the person might even be holding 23%, they're able to go to the bank and have this personal relationship with the banker where they can actually stop the black shareholder from even accessing that account. And at times we find that the person found the black person running the company and requested to have a shareholding in that company, but somehow they end up hijacking that their bank account, and the person no longer has access to the finances of the company. So we asking a question to say, what is the role of banks in this particular instance? And we even feel that at times you could, when you look at it, it could even be seen as money laundering, because where you are a 51% black owned entity, money comes in today, 21 million. Within an hour, that money is moved into somebody's personal bank account. How is that possible? And they just leave enough to keep the bank account going. So those are some of the questions that need to be addressed, or issues that need to be addressed. And then we have referred four cases to CIPC, where it was issues where the Companies Act was contravened. We have also referred a case to your National Prosecuting Officer and Office and staff, your South African Police Services. Now, with Program 3, what's happening really here is the issues of research and analysis and reporting, because we are also required to produce a national status report on transformation. So far, we have done four mini-reports, if I can call them that. Just looking at your BBBE certificates, what are they showing us is the transformation, and also looking at your JSE-listed companies. What we have found is that there was a report where JSE said, there's transformation, that we've got 23% black-owned companies on the JSE, and NEF disputed this and pegged it, I think it was 3% or... Yeah, but in fact, what's coming out is that even that 3% might be an exaggeration. We might actually be at an even lesser number, especially based even on the transactions that we have seen coming through, where literally there's no transformation. So I think when we issue now our annual, because the first one that you did was a baseline, now we've done our own internally, I think that one will give you even a better picture. But what the report has shown us, because here we're looking at the sectors, we took the transport, agri-BEE, and construction. Transport seemed to be doing quite well, but it could be that because transport has not yet been amended, they're still using the old codes. Maybe once the amendments are published, the picture might be different. But from what we're assessing, transport seemed to be doing quite well, especially on issues of management control and ownership. And I guess also they were looking at the issues of your owner-driver schemes, which also are questionable. So the picture might actually not be as it looks. And then when you move to relationship building and stakeholder relations, when you look at our functions, one of the things that we are required to do is to have collaborations. And some of the entities have actually been mentioned in the Act, which is your SARS, your NPA, and your SARS. So we have had meetings with your NPA, your SARS, and SIU as well, because we identify them as a key stakeholder. Draft memorandum of agreements with those have been done. We're just waiting for them to be signed. But we also identified other entities. So with companies and Intellectual Property Commission, we have signed an agreement. With the Commission for Employment Equity, we have signed an agreement. Your South African National Accreditation System, we also have an agreement in place. And then in 1617, we also signed an agreement with the National Gambling Board. So now we just await your SARS and your NPA and your SIU, and also did one with the National Liquor Authority. That one also awaits signing, because it makes it easier to do referrals and also to work jointly on cases where there's a need to do that. And then with Program 5, it's really our operations. It's like your corporate services, where they are required to set up systems for us. So for 18-19, they were supposed to do ICT year plan, to produce an ICT year plan and implement it. The strategy has been done, and the plan has been developed already, and then now they're in the implementation phase. And then the systems that they were supposed to develop based on the ICT year plan, the website has been developed and is operational. The financial systems have been developed and await implementation based on when the entity gets listed. And then currently, then we will be looking at the issues of your case management system, which needs to be your HR, your human resource system, and your contact center system. Those must still be developed. We also, on April last year, launched a triple B portal for BE certificates, where your verifiers then upload information. In fact, when I was referring to the research, that's where some of the information has been taken from. And then we had 10 officials trained on investigations. And then in terms of the number of graduates, we had said this year we won't be doing any intake, but then we have had to review that. So we have taken two for 18-19, and then for 19-20 will take 10, and 20-21 will take another 10. Now, the annual events, these are the bigger events, not just your normal workshops, that we conduct. When we were starting, we realized that there was a lot of complaints that were centered around fronting. So we decided to have an annual conference, which was also kind of a mini launch for the commission. We were just looking at the issues of fronting and what was happening there. This was done in March 2016. We had 326 delegates attending. After that conference, because one of the things that kept coming out was the integrity of the verification process. So we then had a session with the verifiers themselves, which was attended by 176 of them, and there were issues that were raised for them. Also, there were concerns that they would be losing a bit of a pie because EMEs were no longer being verified, and they were questioning the integrity of the SON affidavit. But for us, we feel that the SON affidavit as well holds more integrity than a certificate, a BE certificate, because it's me as a person saying I solemnly swear that the information I've provided is the truth. A certificate, I can even give you false information, whatever. No one's going to hold that person accountable. So those are some of the things we had to iron out. And then last year we had a conference where we were presenting the first baseline study on the status of national state of transformation, where we had looked at the JSE listed companies and also the portal that we had launched, just to give a sense of what was happening. What we found is that as far as females in JSD listed companies are concerned, black females, the numbers are dismal. At least you do find some males, but females are the numbers that are there in those JSD listed companies are quite dismal. In fact, when you find black people, it's mostly foreigners rather than local people. And we wonder whether companies or some companies are aware that the Act is talking to black South Africans, not just any South African. And also this is also based on some of the questions that we're receiving, where they don't get scores for black foreigners, and they wonder why, and we have to explain. And then this year we now targeted the state to say, how can the state actually, as the person that holds the most money, use BEE to bring about the real transformation, and looking at the issues of incentives and grants and procurement to say, who are we procuring from and what are we buying from those people, and how can we use this as our leverage to transform the economy, and to say why they are not submitting their compliance report. So next day we'll be able to show you as well how the state is performing as far as implementation of BEE is concerned. As far as awareness sessions are concerned, in 2016-17, what we were doing was more proactive sessions. But then in 17-18, we received too many requests. We could not do our own proactive. As you can see, in 17-18, we had 80 sessions where we were called to come and present to companies and to government. Whereas in 16-17, we were targeted to do 15, we ended up doing 23. This was based in 17-18 on request. The next slide I've already presented, so I'll move along. And then this is just to show you a breakdown when you look at the complaints handled, where in 16-17, we received 222 complaints, and the spike was in quarter 2, where we got 73. And then last 17-18, the numbers went down a bit, and we think maybe it could have been the issue of our compliance-driven strategy, where people are becoming aware and we're starting to comply. We still have to check whether that's because we have just done a survey in March, and then that survey will tell us whether the compliance strategy is working or not. We're just busy with analysis of that. We received 112. And then the types of complaints, as you can see, and I mentioned earlier, that fronting is prevalent, followed by your invalid triple B certificate, contracts follow that, and then the misleading adverts, at times where people will put an advert to say, it's like literally saying, come, let us show you how we can circumvent triple the legislation. So we have had to have some of them take down those websites, and some to cancel whatever they were doing. And then others, it could be issues of labor matter that doesn't fall under us. Now, as far as complaints per sector, you can see that mining is quite prevalent, followed by transport, and then construction. The others, the numbers are lower, and we don't think that this necessarily means that mining might be the bad one. It could be that the other sectors, people are not complaining, maybe they're scared to complain. So that means then we also need to monitor the other sectors, not necessarily take it for granted that it's only mining that has a problem. And then what we've also done is to show you the classification for complaints, clarifications, and opinions. I've already done the complaints. The nice thing to see now is that in 16-17, clarifications were standing at 391. And then in 2017-18, it went up. So the uptake there was quite high for 17-18, standing at 1,212. We're hoping that with the brochure now on frequently asked questions, some of the questions will come down. But then with the publications of the amended AgriBEE construction codes, there are questions that are also arising from there, so maybe the number will still stay the same, we'll see. And then advisory opinions, the numbers have remained static there. And then with complaints, what I've also shown you is what is more prevalent. So most of them is around ownership, but then in quarter 3, management control also spiked a bit, but throughout, as you can see, ownership is the prevalent one. And it's not just the trust or individual or shareholding. We've also seen around sale of assets as well. There have been some complaints around that. And then with advisor opinion again there, most of them is around ownership. And then there was a spike in quarter 1 also on skills development, where they were just questions around of clarity around that. There were schemes that people wanted to put into place, where we had to tell them that, you know, it didn't meet the requirement. And then with media monitoring, as you can see, we got a lot on the print, where it was 160, but then also online we've gotten a lot of hits, 174 in total, and then broadcast 54. And I must mention that most of these we have not paid for. We are fortunate in that respect that BEE sells itself. And I think I will. And these are just the meetings that we have had, either through walk-ins or people want to come and get clarity before they ask for an opinion or to clarify something. In 16-17, it was 289. 17-18, 244. I'll stop there, Chairperson. Thank you so much.
Chair, we're really mindful of the time, but we will then just take you through just this slide. Joseph will just take you through this slide. As we've indicated that in the investigations, of course, we've indicated our findings, but then there's also a part where there's alternative dispute resolution. So these are some of the cases that we've already concluded. I just want Joseph to take you through them just to also give you a sense of what the issues there, what was alleged, and what is it that we did as a solution.
Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, DG, Mr. Lionel October, Commissioner Protocol Observed, morning once more. As a precursor, really, I'll start by saying the alternative dispute resolution, or rather, the as you know, the BE Commission, it's a creature of statute. Therefore, the alternative dispute resolution mechanism is actually encapsulated in Regulation 1511. So these are some of the cases where we felt as a BE Commission that it would be prudent and proper, or rather appropriate, that they be resolved through dispute resolution, having received a request also from the respondents. And when considering the appropriateness of dispute resolution mechanism, the first issue that is of cardinal importance is the redress to the complainant, or redress in particular to the prejudiced party or any party that might have suffered a harm or economic harm in this matter, as a first priority. Then the second priority is to ensure that there is a voluntary contribution towards the promotion of objectives of BBBEE, particularly skills development in the country. Then thirdly, we also ensure that as part of the key condition in the ADR, we ensure that the parties put measures in place to avoid or prevent the recurrence of the purported contravention of the Act. So those are the three key issues. How do you then put measures in place to prevent the recurrence of the violation of the BBBEE? So we're talking about making sure that put the BBBEE plan in place to improve BE status of the entity. Secondly, we allow the directors of the entities and shareholders to attend a BBBEE training so that they can be better equipped to respect transformation in the country and also benefit a lot from BBBEE legislation. And we also allow the complainant, if he's still part of the company, to also undertake such a training. So I think it's twofold. Either they can approach an accredited institution which can provide such a training. Secondly, they can come before the BE Commission. Then we can arrange a full day session so that they get to appreciate the interaction between the regulations and the BBBEE, as well as the codes of good practice, including the sector codes as well. And thirdly, we also ensure that, because most of the issues borders on corporate governance aspects, then we also include as one of the undertaking or a condition that the implicated directors and shareholders will then undertake or attend a training in corporate governance from an accredited institution, and also receive advice from CIPC, the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission, which has been vested with a mandate in terms of Companies Act 2008 as amended to actually guide and implement the Companies Act in South Africa. So I will take you through some cases, indeed, as Commissioner has actually alluded to, wherein we felt that it was appropriate that the matter be addressed through the mechanism that I've alluded to. So one of the first ADR agreement that was ever entered into, wherein it was facilitated by the BE Commission in terms of Regulation 1511, as alluded, is the one in relation to a certain Michael Ndicheni Manukeni and Mukwakwa against Service Pty Limited. The entity which was implicated, it was a Rofupa Pty Limited, which was established as an enterprise development beneficiary of Service. So what happened is that Service took over Songe Landscapers, which was given a contract by Mbumba Aghanam Facilities, which was an entity appointed by DERCO, Department of International Relations and Cooperation, to manage the facilities in its head office in Pretoria. So the nature thereof was to make sure that they put the pot plants, they manage the pot plants in the building. When you visit most buildings, you see that they put flowers there. So there is a facility management company which manages such contracts. And then the contract in question was given to Songe, which was then taken over by Service. Then later on, I think that was about 2010. Then in 2013, the contract was coming to an end and they realized that they needed a strong triple B credentials or an entity with a strong triple B credentials. Then they tapped into Rofupa P2I Limited, which was that enterprise development beneficiary of Service. Then having realized that, no, they needed an entity with a strong credentials. So what happened then, they then short-circuited, or rather signed an addendum to that expiring contract. Remember, it was in 2013. And they signed an addendum wherein they will then say Songe has changed its name to Rofupa. And then Rofupa, it's now referred to as Songe, but they sort of changed the name around, in a manner that they knew that they would still continue to control the account of Rofupa. So the complainants then realized, no, we can't continue with this arrangement wherein when money gets to be paid for the service, I think it was about 79,000 that used to be paid on a monthly basis for a contract with a value of 2.7 million. Then the money was paid on a monthly basis, and what Rofupa will do will just deduct the initially it was 5,000, but later on it was increased to 9,000. They'll just deduct the 9,000, and the difference will then be paid to Service. You can see this is an anomaly, and it will appear as if the contract indeed is that of Rofupa, whereas it's Service that was actually benefiting. And this was actually perpetuated in 2013, and be mindful of the fact that the triple B legislation came into effect or was proclaimed on the 24th of October 2014. So in a way it was a pre-existing contract, but because the contract was later renewed from 2013 to 2017, then even jurisdiction kicked in, then we had to look at the matter when it was brought to us. And the company Service indeed was very cooperative and indicated that the contract was entered into in 2013, and therefore there was no intention on their part to circumvent the legislation in any way. It was a contractual matter. In a way, they mentioned that it was a contractual matter. However, we felt that this appears to be a violation of Triple B Act, and we had to then come up with strong conditions to ensure that the matter or the ATR agreement is watertight. And then we made sure that the value of the contract that was given then had to be, in monetary terms, real monetary terms, in a lump sum now, have to be paid to the rightful recipient, which was Rofupa, as the first issue to address the first cardinal pillar of ADR of redress. Then because it was not all about the redress only, as we said, there was purported violation of the Triple B Act, then we felt it will also be prudent that Service undertake to promote the objectives of Triple B Act, and then they made or rather pledged an amount of 1 million rand, which was then paid towards advancing the objectives of Triple B Act, in particular skills development, and the beneficiary of such 1 million became NEFSAS, which is National Finance Student Aid Finance. national, NEFSAS. And parties also attended the PPP training and corporate governance training. CRPC did assist on the corporate governance aspect, and then on the PPP training we provided such a training to both Mr. Ndicheni, or to the complainants, and just rather put it that way, and to the directors of service. And then we also requested them to commission an audit report for all the contracts that were given between the 2014 to date, and to ensure that there is no such an arrangement taking place throughout the Republic of South Africa, where they have contracts either with organs of state or even private entities. And such a report was given, and then it was analyzed, and we found that all was in order. We continue to do site inspections or site visits to manage the conditions of this particular ATR agreements that we enter into. Second case, it was the one in relation to Mammoet Southern Africa, where in a certain Mr. Hamad Noord Hendricks approached the BE Commission and said that on about 2003, they collectively formed an entity. Remember, Hamad was a director of Crane Hire. Then they formed what one could colloquially call an opportunistic intermediary by the name of Mammoet Greenham in 2003, and wherein Crane Hire had 40% shareholding and Mammoet I think they had 20% shareholding, and then there was Crow Heavy Lift as well, which had a certain percentage in the Crane Co-Hire. And the significant shareholding was in the hand of Mammoet Southern Africa, one of the large entities. So Mammoet took over the account, in essence, and operations because of its significant shareholding. And the black shareholders felt bulldozed. And then what happened there, then we had to also intervene and consider the fact that the matter presents the act, or that the arrangement was actually entered into before the coming into effect of the act. We had to intervene after realizing that the contract also expired early in 2014. And then having facilitated the ADR, then the parties also facilitated a settlement of the matter in the amount of 25 million, which was a share buyback. So they had to part ways amicably, and then the value of the evaluation was conducted, and then they got paid 25 million, 250,000 to be precise, which was the fair value of the shareholding. And in order to address that purported violation, they paid 5 million now in the Central Revenue Fund of the National Treasury, in order to promote the objectives of the PPP Act. And also, they were made to actually attend the PPP training again and corporate governance. And another one, it was Matsiriso, Tempest Fire. The Tempest Fire relates to Mr. Muimai and Mr. Molo, wherein we have also intervened as a BE Commission and facilitated the resolution of a matter, wherein we quantified the value of economic interest which the black complainants were actually deprived of. Or rather, not the complainants per se, but they were prejudiced parties, in the sense that we initiated an investigation against Tempest Fire after receiving an anonymous tip-off. So they were not complainants, they were prejudiced parties. However, and then it's an entity where we also paid a visit to their place of business in Boksburg to see that indeed the ADR conditions are being respected. Yes. We don't want to talk until cows come home, and in the interest of time, I submit that the Honourable Chair and Honourable Members accept that this is a gist. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chair. My apologies for being late. Just a suggestion on that specific slide. It's a very important slide. Can we please get written response with every all of the entities or companies that was listed there, and with the case and what was done? Can we please get that because it's crucial information, and I don't want us to pass out on it. Thanks.
Absolutely, that will be provided. Annette, to the thank you, Commissioner.
Chair, the last part of our slides really it's things that are in the document, which are our SWOT analysis. So we will not take you through it, but I think to ask the committee to note the SWOT analysis as conducted. In terms of our challenges as well, Chair, you'll note that our challenges are the same as when we came here, when we were being conceptualized as an entity. So it's too early for us to actually realize those. So we are continuing to manage those challenges, and hopefully some of them, as we go along, they would fall away. Chair, this is our financial plan. We do realize that certainly no regulator will ever have sufficient money to cover all the work that needs to be done in this country. But I think here, in terms of our financial plan, we've taken into account the fiscal constraints at the moment, but we've also just been conservative about it to deal specifically with what is required. So this is our plan over the period, and the Department of Trade and Industry is handling that, because as you are aware, Chair, the National Treasury indicated that they do not have any additional resources to allocate. So the department needs to find the allocation within its own budget. So we will then leave that to the department to ensure that it is accorded. And Chair, that's our financial plan, our human resource plan, just for noting, Chair. It aligns to our mandate as well as the financial plan that we've already provided. Chair, just in conclusion, therefore, Chair, as I indicated, the list of our initiated investigations is there. And we can talk to some of the issues in there during the questions and answer session, or we can then provide those in writing. But Chair, just to indicate that our assessment indicates that most of the entities in this country, we've got eight levels in BBBE, so from level 1 to level 8, 60% of the entities fall between level 5 and non-compliance. So most of the entities are non-compliant. So our job going forward, as we said, is to try and encourage and move entities more to a compliant state. So we're going to assist them to do that, but where we're required to actually intervene through corrective measures, we'll do so. So those are the things that we just wanted to say, Chair, and we'll improve our accessibility. We want to make sure that we've got a provincial presence. We understand that a lot of community members through trust are actually made shareholders in structures, but they do not know. So we'll increase that in the simplified language and simplified documents that will translate from time to time. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Commissioner, and the Commission for that presentation. There you have it, members. Members, if you want to ask questions, now is the time to raise your hand so that I can acknowledge you. Honourable Mathombo, I apologise. I'm terrible at the languages. You must replace me. You shouldn't have voted for me yesterday. Now you're learning your mistake. Honourable MacPherson, Honourable Clanquini, Esther Hazen, Mbai Buyani. And, yeah, that's it, in that order. Thank you. In that order, please.
No thanks, Acting Chair, and good morning to colleagues.
to the commission led by Mpemba and then the DG and the team. Probably, Chair, I'll raise two aspects in terms of my comments. One will be more about the technicality of the document, this is all. And then secondly, it will be the substantive issues. One of the things that probably in the document one can raise, it's one is that we must be able to thank the team with the report. We know it's a new organization and it's time to find its feet. But there are certain issues, those who are responsible for the document in terms of the planning unit, that one will suggest that you do have some improvements. For an example, if you look at the document on page 16, 19, and 33, I mean the main document, the APP. When you look at the APP, page 16 and until 19, they refer to SWOT analysis. And if you look at page 33, there is a reference to risk management plan. And the two are actually synonymous. But the manner they are being presented, one, they are being presented as two different issues when they are actually one. They should have been consolidated into a risk plan with clear mitigation measures. That's point number one on technicality. Point number two, on the same vein, the issues that we are referring to, the table on intervention and the table on strengths, weaknesses, threats and opportunities, you could see there's a disjunction. Because immediately you want to put an intervention measure, the intervention must speak to your weaknesses and threats. It's very important. You can then probably start to put new things on the intervention. Then there is no correlation from a planning point of view. There is no correlation. That's very important that you probably have to clear that. On the same vein, normally people, when they like to do risk assessment or they do SWOT analysis, they normally could have a cardinal mistake of normally not doing what I normally call it perceived and real risk. Perceived risk is when you put people in a boardroom like this and you have no time to do a verification whether they are real or not real. I don't want to go to each because it will take much longer, Comrade Chair. But you can look at some of those particular risks, that if you have done risk verification, then you could have been in a position to do the risk ranking, whether it's high, moderate, or low. Because some of them are not really risk that we have raised, both in terms of that. That should be the first issue that I thought probably, I know that when people used to work in government, the DG will know, will put people along, but risk verification methodology is very important. Then there is something that is also coming up in the document. You look at your document in terms of presentation, the PowerPoint, and this one. We have to find an alignment. Well, there is an element where we are putting an important information in the PowerPoint presentation. In the PowerPoint presentation, we are also putting information of the last performance. In other words, it gives you what can I call it, a baseline. And in the main document of the APP, there is no baseline. When the organization, I was trying to check with the comrades here, is it year one or year two? But it looks like we have started, is it year two now? In other words, the baseline should have been established. The baseline can either be audited or it's non-audited baseline. I will make an example here, Comrade Chair, of the mistakes that are happening if you look there. Well, the baseline is actually missing. There's nothing wrong with that There's nothing wrong with the performance indicator because it tells you that this is the indicator for this budget. Look at the technical mistake you make on the PowerPoint presentation, but it goes to the other levels. On page 8 of the PowerPoint presentation, your performance indicator and what we are reporting as a performance report of 2016-17, 17-18, there is an issue about PEMBA, issues of unit standards. Here we are using a number of days, which is 30 days, 30 days. But when you give the other part, the unit standard is not the same, it's not time, it's more about the quantity of, what do you call it, advisory opinions. It's very important that consistency you do. Then there's also another issue from a performance point of view on page 9. If I will use the information of 2016, 2017, and 2017-18, your actual performance baseline is now at 83%. But you want to actually perform below what you have done. if you look at 18, 19, 20, 20, 21. Now you want to come at 80%. You rather maintain performance or you enhance performance. Whatever good that we're able to do, probably is one of the things that the team should want to look at. And then I've referred to the matter of the unit standards. If you look at the following way, you use your 90%, 100%, and using something different. But I'll not go to that details because those are more of your technical issue. The other technical issue that you probably would want to look at is with respect to page 32 of the main document around HR plan. Your HR plan in terms of organogram is incomplete because it does not have the space to indicate any vacancy rate. Technically, because we are having that thing. You are saying somewhere in your risk analysis or SWOT analysis, there are HR constraints. Is the organogram and the establishment sufficient or not sufficient? And to what extent are we looking at? Therefore, if you don't put the vacancy rate issue there, you will miss the point to say how then you'll be supported and guided. Secondly, on the same issue, it's an alignment of two documents, probably the team that was putting it up. The team, when they do the HR plan, ultimately the final composite in your page, in the document here, which is the PowerPoint presentation, we have a staffing complement of 115 in year 2018-2019, but this is the complete organization. But when you go to the actual APP, we have decided to programatize it. Probably you will have better high level before you programatize it, but there's a number two missing. You just have to check. Those two intents that you put in the PowerPoint presentation in the APP, in that year, 18-19, they're all missing. Those will be my technical issues, but I think we are doing a very good job. Still early days, but on fundamental issues, probably DG, this one you need to look at. I know when you do a plan, it's very difficult to do the alignment. You know, I was looking at the sub-outcome, the interlinkages with the NDP and the MTSF. They are trying more to come closer to what is your APP or your strength plan. At the very same time, at an outcome level, there is a point that is being missed. The functionality that is referred to section 13F. If we can say, looking at those functions, where we are and so forth, In the PowerPoint presentation, you start well, you refer to them. But in the actual plan, you can't find the science of the interlinkages. But as a new organization, and she's over a teaching problem. Because ultimately, your performance must be measured against this. At this point, you might not be at 100% in terms of achieving some of the things they accept, because there are clear functions that have been said. But you look at how you couch your plan. The correlation is there in certain aspects, but in certain aspects in the mid is not there. Then you choose and you take this one, but we feel more comfortable, we can do this one. This one we could feel that we can do this one. But you could see there's an attempt to go there. But probably when the team does the strategic engagement, look at it, because you can't lose the tenants. You can't. Even whatever the NDP says, whatever the strategic plan of the department says, in your case, these are your main outcomes. I thought, let me raise those ones without saying pinpointing one or two to say how does it look like. But as I say, probably 40-60% is coming closer to it, but certain fundamentals are missing in terms of that alignment.
Thank you. Next. Who was next?
Myself. Thank you very much. I just want to, Commissioner, go back to a discussion that you and I first had in your office. I think it was last month when I came to lay a complaint against three Gupta Linkton-owned companies for fronting and for misrepresenting their BEE status. When you first brought to my attention the lack of compliance that exists within government entities and departments in terms of reporting, and again you've reiterated that here today. What I don't see, or what I haven't heard, is what is the plan to ensure that they do report and that they do give you information. Quite frankly, it's not up to us as a committee to go out and chase government departments and entities asking them to give them or to give their information to you. So my question to you is what is the plan of action, and what discussions are being held at a ministerial level or at a department level amongst DGs to ensure that that happens? I then want to turn to the document around your investigations. And the one that jumps out to me is on your initiated investigation number 8, and that is the South African Social Security Agency. Now, I would guess that that relates to the CPS contract and the very obvious misrepresentation and fronting that existed to achieve that contract to distribute grants. And I see that it says it's completed. And that is something that actually this committee had raised and requested that investigation to take place. Would you be able to tell me what the next step is in relation to that investigation, and what is the timeline for that? And then with respect to initiated investigations, I would assume that that means investigation that the Commission takes on its own accord. Is that correct, Commissioner? I then would find it interesting why, where there was such a public interest and ventilation of a of quite clear misrepresentation of the BEE status around companies like Trillion and Tegeta and Optimum, why it was left to me as a member of Parliament to come and ask you to investigate that particular issue. Because I mean, you know, one only has to read the front page of newspapers to start putting two and two together around what is going on. And it was, you know, through a bit of homework and working with some verification agencies that we started to map out what this thing looked like. And in fact, I had missed a couple of things that you had pointed out to me when you knew what I was coming to see you about. So how active is the initiation by the Commission into looking at very public and very obvious cases of fronting, and how does that process actually unfold? Those are my questions for now, Chair.
Thank you. Next.
Thanks, Chair. Mine is on from 18. I came late, so I didn't get the name. The ladies were explaining the graph there. On the mining figures, complaints that are so high. Mining, transport, and I think engineering for me is also standing out, and energy is also standing out, and marketing. That whole graph, I know you said you are still analyzing the information pertaining to that, why you are getting complaints in those specific areas. So I like to put, like, to put it on record, Chair, that we also get that information back to the committee as to the complaints that are spiking out and construction, actually, 38. So the ones that are, I would think, the ones that are more than 10, we need to look at that complaint. And then on page 25, on the, I think my colleague Ian has touched a lot around it, on the on your SWOT analysis and the information that doesn't maybe perhaps speak to each other. And I think the Commission has said that the very same weaknesses they have presented before to the committee, it stayed the same. I have a little problem with that in terms of, you know, like within 2 years, your information or your weaknesses and strengths can't stay the same. You know, there must be something different, or what have you done about them? Where are you? Are you struggling with the department to sort out these weaknesses? What is it that these weaknesses are still standing, you know, the same? You talked about human resource constraints. Mr. Mashoba have also mentioned on it, what constraints do you have as a human resource in your human resource department? So all of that, I think, needs more clarification to us and stuff, why these weaknesses are still stagnant on your existence. And what can we do as a committee as well to assist you in that regard? And then on page 28, on your human resource plan, you say your permanent staff is 130, and in 2022 it's still going to stay 130. So you don't have an actual plan to say that you will need more staffing yet, but you said in your SWOT analysis you have human resource constraints. So why is one would predict and say that within in 2022, I would want my staffing to be maybe more to assist with some of these areas. It seems like it's just a whole trading out of information. And then yet again on page 26, no budget, no office space to operate, and human resource constraints. This is constantly coming up. So where are you operating from your booth? So we need to find out from where are you operating, because you say no office space. So where do you do your work from then? So it can be that maybe the organization is struggling to do its work or its core mandate. So that one I think I also would want to get clarification. And as well on the lady that was speaking the first time that I came in, she spoke about documentation share. Some companies, they don't want to give documentation and refusal of giving documentation. What I like to know is that then how long does it take to sort out a case like that if you still need to go and give summons for a person that don't want to comply? And which company in your term of office that when you have asked documents, which were those companies that have refused to give the commission the required documentation to finalize the case? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Who's next?
Thank you, Chair. I also want to add on to what my colleagues have started off, baseline, no baseline, I agree with it. And it's also for me a very big concern that a member must ask the commission to do its work. You know, that's very sad. Government and this department has had countless meetings, but nothing is really ever enforced. Nothing is ever enforced. Every year we speak about the slow pace of affirmative action in the workplace needs to improve, but there's never any consequences. There's never any consequences. Is it possible, or are we saying that empowerment and transformation are just no longer important in this economy? Black shareholders sell their stock in empowered white company, and the white company stays in power. So how does that happen? And if I'm not mistaken, empowerment is also now reduced, or I might be wrong, I'm just saying anything, from 50% to 30%. That, you know, I think I've read it somewhere. And how come government entities like Telkom and the Post Office, South African Broadcast Corporation, have changed their CEOs to white males? This is who should lead by example. South African Broadcast Corporation is led by a foreigner, not even a South African. It's because the monitoring devices in government and even this department oversight is not working. That is the problem. And to my, and the other thing is that this whole BEE is also designed and developed to only favor a certain few individuals. We need, the bottom line is that we need to raise the skills and the earning potential of all South Africans, not only a few individuals. Chair, thank you. That's it.
Yes, thank you very much, Chair. Let me first welcome the report, the presentation. And also, I do have some few clarity seeking questions. One, we start the presentation indicated that the SANAS is the only service provider that issuing BEE certificate. I'm not so sure because I just saw something contrary to that on the sweat and analysis and challenges that SANAS issues with MOU with SANAS, but here is the only service provider that issues certificates. And also, I'm not so sure in terms of the 25 million threshold that in terms of your register for measure B is 25 million. What about the ones that they are lesser than the 25 million? Chair, also, I'm not sure because here they indicated that there's no there are pending signatures from the memorandum of understanding with NPA and also SAR. So how are you going to maintain or check as to in terms of whether one is qualifying in terms of BE? Because SAR, they do have documents for all the companies in South Africa. Can we be clarified in terms of the challenges? Because the report is not clear in terms of whether anyone has been prosecuted. Also, the annual awareness event session, seemingly they are in Gauteng only. The BEE commission for the Gautengians only, or for South Africans? If not, why other provinces are not covered in terms of programs? And also, it's very much disturbing to check and hear that 83% fronting. That means white people or somewhere black people are being used in the process. And what are your challenges? Do you have the capacity to investigate, to recommend, or to prosecute as a commission? Because really 83%, that means it's your day-to-day job in terms of the process. And also you can check human resource management. I wanted to check whether do you have skills development strategy, and how many staff members do you have? Because only here we talk of 115. How many staff members do you have in those staff members in terms of gender balance, managerial position, so that we can be able to understand as members, how can we be able to assist you? And also, on the threat, I'm very threatened, Chairperson, by the threat that there's a lack of political backing and support of this commission. So can we be clarified what lack of political backing? Because we are here representing a political structure, the masses of our people, and we are listening to you. What is it that we need to buy as politicians? Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, members. Before I hand over to the Commission and the DTI to answer the questions and the comments, talk to the comments, I've got a few questions and comments myself. My first comment is that BEEE is the main tool of our government to implement economic transformation. And it seems that this tool is basically just being ignored. The legislation's been around for 15 years or thereabouts, and we've still got this massive non-compliance. So what I'd like is I'd like the Commission to give us a list, this committee, a list of the biggest companies that are guilty of non-compliance and fronting and all of the various levels of non-compliance. Including in that list is the size of those companies. So in other words, then what's their turnover? I mean, are we talking about, you know, 83% non-compliance, but it's, or 60% level 5 and down to non-compliance, does that represent 60% of the GDP, or does that represent, you know, is that, you know, what is it? Is it 80% of the GDP? How much non-compliance do we actually have in South Africa when we talk about figures? I also want the government departments to be on that list as well, so that perhaps this committee can call these big companies and government departments to the committee to explain why they're not complying to this legislation. I'd also like DTI to look into whether or not it would be viable to criminalise non-compliance to this BEE. For instance, fronting. I mean, what is really the worst that can happen? I mean, I could form a company tomorrow and I could get some of my comrades in this room to front for me. And then what would happen is if we were caught, I mean, what would happen to me? Nothing. I could form a company the next day. We should seriously consider criminalizing this, because if we don't, as this government, start seriously looking at economic transformation, the transformation that will happen will come in the form of people on the streets. You know, they will, the people will take economic control in an illegal manner. And I think that this committee and the DTI need to become more serious with regard to economic transformation, and in particular the BEE Commission. So if the DTI can explain to us, why is this commission not being given its own budget? Why isn't it being given the necessary tools in order to implement what is fundamentally the government policy of transformation? Thank you. Over to the DTI and the commission. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. May I request that I just allow the DG and the team from the DTI to deal with the policy-related matter. Chair, again, just to emphasize again that as the Commission, we can only implement what is in the legislation. Some of the issues that have come up are issues that the Department can then handle from the policy point of view. Then we will then respond directly to the questions that you have raised.
DTI?
Yes. Thanks for the question. As a Chair, as you correctly indicated, the BEE Act was the principal intervention by government to accelerate black economic empowerment. And as you know, the first time in 2003, the BEE Act was introduced, and then in 2013. It was strengthened significantly, and one of the key features of that strengthening was there was two big interventions. The one is to say that every government leverage, whether it be a license, whether it be procurement, whether it be an incentive, a company must comply with BEE in order to access that incentive. Because as you know, within BEE, the BEE Act is a voluntary act. It is not enforced. Nobody is forced to do black economic empowerment in South Africa. Mm-hmm. So the principal leverage was that we introduced in 2013, and this is the most significant now, is that no license can be issued without the requirement of BEE. No incentive can be paid, and no... The second thing was to establish the BEE Commission. Honourable Chair, what we've done so far is that over the allocation has been 59 million, 61 million, and 65 million to the Commission. And as you know, you are well aware, you have passed the national budget. We have faced significant cuts as a department. What we would ask you is to support us that DTI needs more money for transformation. As you know, all of these entities we've established, we never got one extra cent from National Treasury. Every time we establish a new entity, National Treasury simply tells us, fine, you can start what you want, you can pass whatever act you want, but you must pay from it within your existing budget. So all of our programs that we've introduced, and we've done many, the Black Industrialist Program, we've introduced no extra money. We found it from within our budget, so we had to reallocate resources. This 61 million that we've done for the BEE Commission, we've reallocated. So as you know, and we prepare to give you the full budget, and we present that to you every year, and this way, so this is how we're going to allocate our resources. As you know, it means if we give to one, we must take from somebody else. So you must then tell us if you want to say cut out the National Consumer Commission and give their 10 million to the BEE Commission. So as you know, we do an overall assessment. We are trying to shift money to transformation and to productive and to jobs. So our core criteria for allocation is that we need to accelerate transformation, and we now need to accelerate jobs through investment in manufacturing. So those are the two allocations we've done. Even with the staff with the BEE Commission, it is still limited and we want to increase it, but we've taken from the existing staff of the department and we basically reallocated. As you can see, Zodwa was heading up our CCRD division. She has agreed to take on this responsibility to drive now the BEE Commission. All of the staff that you have here, they come from within the DTI. So as I said, we have had to balance the resources. But Honourable Chair, I think you've gone on to the big issue. The BEE Act As you say in the beginning, it says that South Africa's economy, the key part of the preamble is that South Africa's economy still excludes the vast majority of its people from ownership of productive assets and the possession of advanced skills. So what we are really talking about is the transformation of the productive sectors of this economy, which means it's private assets. So the task of BEE is to ensure that assets are also transferred to black people. So therefore, what you must inquire about the slow pace of transformation, you must do what the Finance Committee has done in Parliament. They summoned the financial sector and asked them, what have you done about transformation? They gave their reports, Nedbank, Standard Bank, everybody there, and then they said to them, these are going to be the remedial actions you're going to take to accelerate transformation. So I suggest, of course, there's a lot to be done in government itself, but there's more to be done in the private sector. And I suggest what you said is, let's summon the largest players. As you say, South Africa is a very concentrated economy. In every sector, it's owned by five or six companies. So you need to only call about 20, 30 companies, and you will have 90% of GDP in this room. And then let's ask them to explain how far they are. I think that is the way forward. Otherwise, we're going to keep blaming the wrong people. As I said, I don't take away anything from... We're constantly pushing our SOEs to do more, but at least they are doing... 50% of their procurement is going to black companies. Eskom, no matter what state it is, 50% more procurement goes to black companies. They have created black companies. If you take the Auditor General's office, the bulk of their work goes to black auditing firms and so on. So I think it's a lot to be done. But if you take the ones, if you take Sasol or you take Nedbank, 5% of procurement goes to black companies. So I'm saying if you're going to advance the key objective of the Act of transferring productive assets to black entrepreneurs, we must focus the Act on the sector which must do the transformation.
Thank
you, Chair. If I may comment, Vicky has mentioned now, and I said that this is not enforced, and I know BE is not enforced, it's an instance. Eskom that you just mentioned, Exxaro has changed their board to 50% black control. Who does Eskom buy their coal from Exxaro? So it's not enforced. We have policies and we make legislation and things, but we're not keeping to it. That's Eskom that you just mentioned, about one of our issues.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to just respond to the issues in broad, but if I don't get to cover all. I think the important thing DG has mentioned, there is nothing in the legislation that says a company must implement BEE. So the way this legislation was structured is that government was used as a leverage to say, if you want to do business with government, then you need to comply with BEE. So the point that I raised earlier was that government itself is not implementing that. You go through the licenses that are awarded and issued to companies, you still find that the triple BEE requirements have not been requested. You go to the big deals that are awarded by, for instance, your Eskom, a big billion tender or whatever, there is no BEE requirements. So the point that we are making about government doing the implementation is exactly arising from that. It is immaterial for us to be chasing companies to say you're fronting, but these companies are still getting the very same deals from government. Government doesn't implement it. It makes the work of the commission really trivial. It gets to be trivialized because then BEE is not important. So when we look at these issues, we looked at what is it that is going to make our strategy to work. So if government is still going to continue as it continues, then we're not going to get anywhere. But the point that DG made right now to say, you know, some entities, you know, over 50% of their work goes to black entities, that is information that as the commission we do not have, because those entities have not given us those reports. Those are the reports that we're talking about under 13G, for us to be able to assess if indeed that is happening. So those reports are not coming. But what we can tell you right now is that the government departments that we've engaged with have indicated to us that no, they're not the ones that are required to be implementing these things. In fact, they have no clue that they're supposed to implement it. So hence we've said that also as part of our strategy is to engage the very same departments to ensure that they're implementing. For instance, procurement requirements of a lot of government entities are still the same as they were 10 years ago. So they have not been adjusted to take into account the BBB requirements. So as I said, the government was a leverage when this policy was done, and there's nothing that the commission can do. We cannot change that aspect, but we can only implement what is in the legislation. So coming to the issues around resources, I saw Linda is here from the media. I always said before, I think, no, she's not. Okay. I've always said that sometimes when we come to the committee, because it's an open committee, when we speak about how many investigators I have, then I have the very same companies that we must look into actually second-guessing us and actually, you know, assessing how quickly we're going to get to them. So we don't come to this committee to raise those issues, but we normally raise them with the department and also so that they can then, you know, be in a position to allow us the resources. But just to tell you, in terms of just the investigation, we only have full-time, we only have 14 staff members. The rest of the people that we have in the organization is interns that we took in to help with our mandate. We do not have any additional staff members. We've only got 14 people. So if we talk about those 334 investigations that we're talking about, there's only 5 people working on those investigations. So some of the things that we have done as well. So just to respond to the Honorable Chair, sorry, member here, when you mentioned that we have not, in our resource plan, we still say 113. If we even get close to that 113, we'll be happy. So over the 3 years, if we have this, we are fine, so we don't need additional resources. What we are working from at this point is that we don't even have that. So that is why you'll see that it's constant. There's no need to increase it for us in this period if we have it for this year. All right. So I think that's just to explain how our plan and what is the actual relates to. We didn't elaborate on that because we're really mindful. As a regulator, if people know your weakness is too much, then they are already, you can't get to them. You can't get to them. So, and we must apologize for not elaborating on that. It was because of that reason. But in terms of the other improvement points that have been made by the honorable members, can we please just accept them, and then we'll then, you know, improve on them. We're not going to respond on them, and then we'll then just improve going forward. And then just in the response to Honourable McPherson about how we do our initiations. Our initiations obviously will also be in accordance with our resources, but in terms of matters, we monitor the media on a daily basis. So we've got a media monitoring entity that gives us all of the media articles and everything that relates to BBBE. It might be that in some instances a matter gets to be brought to us before we proactively initiate on it, but in most of the matters, if you look at the matters that we have identified there on a proactive basis, given the time that actually we started operating recently, all of the matters that are appearing and are prominent in the papers and where we think that there's merit to intervene, we intervene. So in respect of the issue around, for instance, Trillion, for instance, it would not immediately be an issue if Trillion has got 0% black ownership. However, if Trillion has misrepresented itself to an entity that it's got more black ownership than what it actually has, and we pick that up, then we will then follow up on it. But the fact that it's got 0% black ownership, it is not something, it's not a basis to act on its own. Because companies are not forced to be having a certain percentage of BEE. But I think without getting really into that issue in too much detail, because it might also compromise the fact that we are investigating the matter and if we're speaking to that. But in general terms, we look into those issues. But there's a lot of matters that we are not reporting to in here that we do through our oversight. So when we pick up an issue in the media, we'll write to an entity first to give it an opportunity to respond to us. And based on the response, then we'll determine if there is an issue to actually get involved in. And in that case, then we'll initiate. So all of the cases that we've mentioned, there's initiation. Most of them is where we've actually asked them for specific information. In some instances, where we've done a site visit and we find that what they're telling us is not what we see, then we'll initiate. But I have indicated what our limitations are in terms of talking about specific matters, but we have given you some sense of what the issues are in there. And in respect of the SASA matter, we've indicated that the SASA matter is complete. However, some of the things that we had to look into in terms of that investigation is also in relation to some of the judgments that were granted by the Constitutional Court in respect of the same matter, but also looking into what the black ownership of CPF, as was presented to SASA when the contracts were when the bids were open and when the analysis was done, and post the award of the contract, whether the black ownership remained the same. So that investigation is complete, and so all that remains is for the findings to then be issued and be published at the relevant time. So we've already indicated again the steps that need to be taken up until where we are publishing a formal document. So you'll see that where we have completed an investigation, we'll publish, like in the SAP&T matter, where we've investigated and finalized the investigation, and there's no referral for criminal prosecution. Then there, we allowed to then publish that finding. So in that case, with SAP&T, in terms of the manipulation of financial statements and how they do verification, we've already done that. So similarly, with all of the other 45 findings that we've already issued, we'll then be publishing them formally. The ones that have been referred for criminal prosecution, we cannot publish them until the NPA makes that decision to prosecute. Only at that time they become public. In terms of the information around the sectors and the number of complaints, we take note of that, and then we'll provide the written response once we have analyzed that information, because it's very quick for us as well to say with the stats for 2 years, to say whether when we see a lot of complaints in mining, whether it means there's a problem specifically in mining. But what you'll find in mining is that sometimes the number of complaints are also exacerbated by the fact that there's the trust and the community schemes that are there. You find that there's more complainants in one matter as well, or you know, a number of people lodge the same complaint, but they all relate to the 26% shareholding that is always given in the mining sector, and the beneficiaries are saying that over the period, some dating from 2005, they have not received any value out of that in terms of that shareholding. If it's black shareholding, they don't know it because it hasn't vested, but they also don't get any dividends or any distribution throughout the year. Those are the typical things that you'll see, but we'll give that information as we go. In terms of office space, because of the fact that we do not have...
Just a moment, yes. Honourable Member. Continue.
Thanks. Just in terms of the office space, just to indicate that when we started, we do not have our own office space. We're co-locating with the National Gambling Board. So we don't have our office space. So that's an issue of budget that I think the DG has indicated. The current space that we have cannot accommodate even more than 40 people. So at the moment, with our interns, we're in the total of 37 people. And that's about it. We cannot even add a single additional body to that structure. But those are the things, as I indicated, that we are engaging with the department on and to finalize. The clarity around SANAS. All the verification professionals or verification agencies that you see, whether it's EmpowerDex, EmpowerLogic, Empower whoever, all of those people, for them to be able to have the right to verify and issue certificates, they are accredited by SANAS. So SANAS doesn't issue certificates. It accredits the entities that then are allowed to issue certificates. So which means that if you're an entity and you're not accredited to verify and issue certificates by SANAS, then whatever certificate you are issuing is illegal. So when we spoke earlier about our report about some of the certificates that we've instructed to be withdrawn from the market, is where some auditors that are just operating, they feel that they can issue certificates. They are not allowed to do that. So SANAS does not issue any certificate, but accredits, and it's in terms of the regulations that were issued by the department that is the one that oversees the verifiers. And then in terms of the 25 million threshold for major triple B transactions, in the minister's notice, the minister says that any transaction that is below that 25 million threshold, it can be registered voluntarily. However, if the commission suspects that there's something that may be untoward with it, the commission can call for it to be notified. So we still have an opportunity to call for it if we pick up that there may be issues with that transaction. But the 25 million is the threshold for that. And then in terms of the annual events that they're all in Gauteng, when I concluded, Chair, I indicated that our focus this year is going to be to spread our services provincially. And that links up to our resources. But in realization that we don't have unlimited resources, the one thing that is in our plan this year is a mass media campaign where we're going to specifically translate our material and the work of the commission and the requirements into various languages, and we're targeting community stations and also FAB stations that are reaching a lot of people, so that where we are not able to be there physically at the moment, but we can still send the message so that people can be able to react to the commission and report some of the things if they find them. And then some of the issues around the MOUs, we've indicated the MOUs are pending purely because of the change in the leadership. So they we have negotiated, for instance, with the SARS, it complete. All that needed to be done was just to sign off. So we just think from organization to organization, it's just a matter of just picking that up and then finalizing those things. Those are important and crucial MOUs for us because that relationship is critical. Chair, at the risk of going for too long, please stop me. If you think that there's one aspect that I need to address that I haven't, but I'm just looking at the issues and quickly, but and hopefully we have done that. But to just indicate, just to say that in terms of the entities, what is encouraging for us is that we have seen that a number of entities don't come for BEE only because they think they will need to deal with government. In fact, a lot of entities now are coming for us to assist them to have a proper BEE plan and to actually do the compliance properly now so that they are competitive. So it's now a competitive issue. So it's no longer about whether you're getting a tender from government or not. So for us, that is a bit encouraging. And to say, yes, there may be gaps in the legislation, but we are seeing more and more companies approaching us voluntarily and others approaching us to change. Yes, there are a few ones that, as we've indicated, where there's a clear non-compliance, we'll then take action and then we'll then publish those findings. Chair, I'll just stop at that and just to say thank you very much for the committee again for raising these issues. For us, this is work in progress, but at least we do know where we are going. And when we said the issue about the political support, I think as the commission, we think that BEE from a transformation point of view is very critical. So once Parliament adopts it as a policy and puts a legislation, we think it will be in the interest of this country if the political support from all angles pursues the objectives that have been adopted by this Parliament, because it's one Parliament at the end of the day. So that is the type of support that we would like to see, and so that the Commission can also be encouraged to elevate these issues as critical as they are at the moment. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you. Honourable Mashlobo, and then Honourable McPherson, Honourable Esther Hazen, Honourable Lanquini. Sorry, 2 minutes, please, because we have got a serious time constraint here. Thank you.
No, thanks, Chair. Well, I think we should probably find time with the committee alone to probably discuss some issues of the method of work, because there are fundamental issues. We are looking at APP, but other issues are coming up. and it makes it difficult how to interact because other comrades are going on the other route. But quickly, probably one, we should support the team and the plan that is them with those technical issues. Probably as a suggestion, because the commission are coming at the tail end when everything has happened. While in certain instances we look to do facilitation, probably when we meet with DTI, we should be able to say what we have in the hands of the state as levers to drive transformation. The question of licenses, permits, incentives, the issues of tariffs, the issues of procurement and others, we'll probably have to find more discussion because it's not your problem. It's the country's problem and see what we do. Then there is an issue that I think we need to look at in a big way. The question of alignment, which becomes a hindrance. When there is a criticism in the state, remember there's been the Preferential Public Procurement Framework Act. That has actually been in contradiction with the DEA for quite some time. That assignment makes it more difficult. Then there is an issue around the economic crimes, because I can see we are raising issues around economic crimes. Also do an analysis, because it takes different forms. For an example, fronting apart from the certificate, fronting can lead to issues of money laundering. Fronting actually can lead to corruption. Fronting can also lead to issues of illicit flows, including cessations of contracts. You see, it's not that you must ask you questions, but you must also say what other aspects, because whether the legislation makes sense or not. Then there is this issue around enforcement. The act is very clear. You make a mistake, you can be thrown away for 10 years. It's there in the legislation now. But how do you ensure that there is an integrated law enforcement? I'm happy that you're looking at SARS. Don't look only at SARS. Look at Department of Labor. Look at Air Security. There's an Economic Intelligence Unit there. Look at Treasurer. There's Speaker that is there. And there are a lot of them in terms of the integratedness of the systems. Because I could see want to develop an ICT system. Sometimes you don't need to develop one. You just have to superimpose the other that will be able to get the data from the other so that you could be in a position to move. And then the last point, Chen, we have to use the DE report, either by government or as legislators of the country, and ask ourselves difficult questions. And why have we failed? One of the reasons why DE enters the fail all the time, apart from other reasons, in the name, is to say, how do you choose the entrance? Because companies, they are actually abusing this. Everybody coming in as a partner, you don't have the capacity, even from the beginning. Number two, you don't actually even have the resources that are there. But probably when we receive the BE report at a particular point in time, we should be able to say, is there a gap in legislation? Is there a gap in terms of planning? And what do we need to do different? On your administration, you have too many administrators on program 5, while your investigators are very low. You look at program 1 to program 4, program 5, you have 47 people and you are saying you have only 14. Please just look at each and their capacity. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. I think we're going to disagree on sort of how we should be looking at issues in the public. I mean, suffice to say that Trillium with 0% black ownership, as stated by them, received R1.5 billion worth of work from Eskom. So, I'm not sure how that, it could be missed or not really taken as a problem. But I'd like to turn to a particular issue regarding the declaratory order around the once empowered, always empowered principle. And I'd like to hear from the DG specifically whether the DTI had any interest in the case, what their view is on the declaratory order. I personally think it's good. I think it provides clarity. I think it stops double dipping. I think it allows businesses that once they have achieved their BE levels as required, that they are not continuously having to going out looking for, to top up as the judge had found, and whether this is something that the department agrees with. Thank you.
Next.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think it's not why we failed. I think if we say failed, the state has failed then. Why, Madam, you mentioned the state entities. We must have start with somewhere for people and consequences. Mr. Coco, at the time, I've got the colleague here that's also in energy. In the committee, we queried him why was the contract given to Exxaro, and like the member mentioned, creating corruption and things. This contract was given at absorbent prices, much higher than the existing coal prices, was still given to Exxaro. His daughter didn't even work there, so I don't know why he gave her the... But in any case, that happened. It happened, and it's a state entity, and it wasn't fully the compliant.
Sorry, members. Can you just move to a mic that works, perhaps?
She think I jammed
it. Jammed it.
Thank you, Chair. My one is just on the Act, per se. The Act is, and my colleague has mentioned too, it says about the 10 years imprisonment. How many cases have gone that route, or how many individuals was prosecuted by the NPA in terms of the Act? Because I see you have given us a list of cases as well that were completed. So mine is just on that, and I want to emphasize it as well as to our colleagues. When you come here, Commissioner, don't be scared to tell us your weaknesses. That's why we're here as a parliament to assist you. And, to enforce that you get more staffing. Because your staffing confidence is not correct. And to operate in the manner that you are operating, none of these cases will be sorted out. You have about, I don't know how many cases that are put on here. You know, there's a whole list. And with the staffing confidence that you are having, you're not going to go anywhere. And these individuals will just slip through the process and just continue as they are continuing. So I think when you're getting here, tell us, don't be scared to tell us your challenges. We are here to assist you as a parliament. We are not here only to criticize you. We want the parliament and government to work. And that is the only way you're going to succeed, if you're going to tell us and be honest about your challenges. And I'm quite frank, in this committee, that we do assist in the departments that do come here, and entities that are putting their challenges down. So don't ever be scared putting and telling us your challenges, or feel the need that you need to hide it from us. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Nate.
No, thanks, Chair. I think I'm partially covered by what Honorable Mahlobo and Tangwini have just raised. But my question initially was not covered in terms of responses. The skills development plan, whether they do have, and how far they may be, because I can see only the 6% here. And I'm not sure what it talks about in terms of developing the skill moving forward. Because here, you can have a staff complement, but if you don't establish a second layer leadership for them to take over where you left, I think you have serious challenges in terms of that. And also the challenges that just was raised, the triple PFMA vis-a-vis the triple P. Can we have maybe a written proposal from the commissioner as to where, as parliamentary, can be able to assist you guys to be effective in monitoring and also dealing with your issues? Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'm not going to allow the Commission to respond. I'd like those responses in writing by Monday, but I just want to make a comment to the Department. DTI, DG, you said that it's not compulsory to transform as a company. It's voluntary. And we've had many years of inviting, let's say, these companies to transform, and yet they've failed. Is there some mechanism or some report that you can give to this committee explaining exactly what we can do about this? Because if we continue down this road and we continue with this voluntary transformation that we're heading towards, nothing is going to change. And in 10 years' time, we'll have 60% of the companies in South Africa still not complying. So if we can have some mechanism on what we can actually do about this, and if you can put that in writing to the committee as well. And I'd like to thank the Commission for coming today. And I'm sorry we're moving so quickly, but we have run out of time completely. And I'd like to move to the next presentation. Unfortunately, people have to stand up and leave because the venue is so small, so that we can bring in the next people. Thank you very much. So we'll just take a quick 5-minute break to just do that. Thank you.
Yes, I'm not sure. 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 I'm
Andre, I sent you that ID copy.
Yes, thanks. Yeah. Listen, are you indicating that you're going to meet with
Thursday.
Yes, I need to know that for sure that you have a good ticket and I can make sure that you're
on the 26th. Yeah.
And you only get your mention, I think, on the 20th. That's fine. As long as you could come later and pick up by the 20th, by Friday or next week.
Okay, cool.
Then I want to change my mind. I'll probably go leave this to Friday.
Yeah.
And then we'll leave.
Okay, I'm going to find some hotels for you.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So you'll fly to London and then I'll take it fine.
I'm going to fly to Manchester.
Now you're going to come back from Manchester.
Okay.
Listen, you should have checked the specifications.
Okay.
There
shouldn't be much difference.
Yeah.
Whatever the difference is, really,
I don't want any hassle with this kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I'll ask for that. So then I'll
But I'd like to leave in the evening.
No, it's
like
you're doing about 6
o'clock.
Yeah.
I
think it's 6 o'clock.
Yeah. I'll check for it.
When do they want to post my ticket, Andre?
I want you to sort it out by Monday. Turn the ticket in.
Yeah.
But I think I'm going to turn the stuff in. I don't want to have a problem with
the ticket. Because I'm also trying to arrange stuff around.
Sorry, could you please take their seats? Time is a problem here.
Cool. Okay.
Okay, members, we're going to reconvene now. Up next is the follow-up engagement with the DTI on the 2018-19 annual performance plan. They didn't finish last time, so we're going to just continue with the questions that they haven't answered. They're going to come back to those. So I'll hand it over to the DG, and we can continue from there. Thank you.
Honourable Chair, thank you for the opportunity to come back to you again and for giving us two slots. As you indicated, we presented our APP on the 20th of March, and because the report is so comprehensive, there was a number of issues that you asked us to clarify further. And those issues we've listed in a letter to you, but it's been around the Auditor General's report, around the incentives, and around the special economic zones. Those were the three essential areas that was left outstanding. So, Honourable Chair, I've got the team with me, as you know. I must say that I've got apologies. As you know, there's a big meeting of the Commonwealth Heads of Mission meeting in London at the moment, so we do have a number of Deputy Director Generals are at that, and that's why they are replaced here by their very competent and giving them experience is our Chief Directors are acting for them. But I also have also with me, as you know, we've introduced our recently appointed Deputy Director General, Dr. Evelyn Masocha. She is a three-week-old doctor.
I have a bad knee, if she could look at it. I've got a bad knee.
Okay. So very briefly then, and we'll be open for questions. On the question of the Auditor General, let me just confirm that most of the issues raised was around the performance information. As you know, we have received over the past 3 years, we've received clean audits because it looks like we've sort of cleared the hurdle on financial controls within the department. Also, on terms of controls with regards to HR matters. And the only issue which is still the subject of intensive discussion with the Auditor General is our performance information. And it is in that regard that we have set up a very clear system. As you know, the Auditor General has now been is wanting to measure the APPs against the National Development Plan. So all of us have to reformulate and formulate our targets. And as you know, there's a criteria for setting a target, and it's called SMART, which means it must be specific, it must be measurable, it must be able to be specified clearly in numbers, and so forth. So we've laid out the procedure. What we do have is a system with the AG and with our audit committee. We meet even at ministerial level about 3 or 4 times during the audit, where at the start of the audit we agree with the AG what are the parameters, and then we table our report. We then assess it midway, and so on. So we've got a clear system, and I set that out. But as I said, it is a very, especially on the issue of performance information, because we obviously are mainly driven by economists, and we're trying to set our targets, which is appropriate to meet our economic and our transformation targets. So that's on the AG's office, and I think we've now reached agreement on all our sort of performance indicators, all of those matters are resolved. And we've also just completed the financial part of the audit. The financial statements have been signed off, so we will be starting the auditing process from now. On the question of then incentives, and the biggest issue that arose here is just the role of incentives, industrialization, and jobs. Let me then start with the incentives. I've got here the Deputy Director General, Malebo Mbiji-Thompson, and what she will say is that for all our incentives, we specify there that you must have either job retention or job expansion. So that is a condition of every incentive. So for example, as we indicated, we've got very, very big companies in the country. What they did was they had a retrenchment exercise during the period of our incentive. We then don't pay out the incentive. And the lesson we want to teach that company is that what you must at least do, because you've got a government intention, you must at least retain that workforce. So that is what we do in terms of job creation. As you know, in terms of manufacturing, the manufacturing sector now employs 1.7 million people directly. And as you know, the World Bank has said that every job in manufacturing creates 4 jobs indirectly. And therefore, the manufacturing sector sustains over 5 million jobs. So when we deploy our incentives is mainly deployed at ensuring that there is investment in machinery and equipment. Now, as you know, before any job can be created, a company must invest in machinery and equipment. And the leverage factor we generally can use is that for every one rand of investment that we put in, the company puts in 5. So it's a leverage factor of about 5 for all the investments that we put in. Where our incentive plays the role of A, lowering the cost for that company, and therefore obviously making it more profitable so that they can sustain and create jobs in the long run. So as I said, for example, the automotive industry, which makes up 33% of the manufacturing sector. So 500,000 jobs are created by the auto industry. And as you know, it is only because of the DTI incentive that that industry exists in this country. We have a live example of other country that withdrew their incentives, and they have 0 automotive industry. Australia did it. They withdrew the incentive, and now they have exactly 0 of an industry. So we make the point about our incentives that what we must do is increase our incentives. if there is any reduction in our incentive, then you must accept there's going to be a reduction in jobs. It's a simple mathematics, because every other country tries to provide more incentives to attract away companies. As you know, in the US, every state offers a massive incentive package for companies to locate there. All over the world, the automotive industry, Thailand, Malaysia, China, Singapore, all of them, they have massive incentives. European Union, everybody has massive incentives. So if you withdraw an incentive, you must then accept that you're going to reduce the jobs in South Africa. Of course, we must always leverage and add to the conditionalities, what we call the principle of reciprocity in our incentives. For every rand the state puts in, it must extract massive value for that. So as I said, in terms of investment, we attract up to 4 or 5 times the level of investment that we put in. But then also, as you know, we've done black economic empowerment as a requirement. You must have a certain level of BEE in order to get the incentive. We also have incentives for you to go into the parts of the country where there's been underinvestment, and that's why we go into special economic zones, we go into industrial parks, we go into the township economy, and we try to redirect behavior in that, and so forth. So that's on the incentive regime. But let's say that incentive is only just one leg, because as you know, a country, a company, and an economy is driven by supply and demand. So incentives only affects the supply side. So the company can have all the best and most modern equipment in the world, but if nobody buys its products, it is nothing. And as you know, the key issue, and it relates to the earlier discussion, is transformation. If there's no demand from the company's products, then they go out of business, irrespective of the amount of incentive they receive. So therefore, for example, Tiger Brands, Unilever, Nestle, they control the market because they control access to the retail chain and so on. So a big part of our transformation is to break open the access on the demand side of the economy, to give people access to markets. And that's why, as you know, we have been spearheading for 10, 15 years the 30% set aside. It's finally coming to legislation very late, but 30% of procurement must be set aside by companies for black companies. And that's how you open up the demand side of the economy. So we're also arguing that we must always see supply and demand, or incentives and demand going together. And you cannot just measure an incentive purely on whether a government gives an incentive or not. You must say, is there a market and is there aggregate demand? Then turning to special economic zones. Honourable Chair, there was, as you know, we're moving to create 10 special economic zones in the country. We're at number 8 now, and over the years it has expanded massively. As you can know, before there was only Kuga and it's London. Everybody, there's now quite a few. There's Richards Bay, there's Dube, there's Aldana, there's Malutia Pofong, there's Mosina, Mikado, and others. So the special economic zones work on a very simple principle, and that is, it is a collaboration between national government, the province, and the city. And if those three organs can work together, then you have a successful special economic zone, but it cannot just be run by one tier of government. Secondly, the basic logic of a special economic zone is that you provide world-class infrastructure, and in that way you ask companies to locate within that zone. But what you must provide is firstly world-class infrastructure, meaning water, electricity, bulk infrastructure, cheap rentals, land, but also efficient services for them to when they enter the zone. And that is relates to the question of investment and the cost. So the upfront costs are very high because you have to provide the world-class infrastructure. And you can see the results of that. For example, when China was looking to build a 12 billion automotive plant, the zone they went to and they immediately chose was Kuhak, because they said this zone is equal to Shanghai. This is the same thing they will get in Shanghai, the quality of the infrastructure and the quality of the service the management team was able to provide them. And as you know now, if you drive past there, there's a massive investment taking place in Beijing automotive works. But so therefore you will find there must be a big investment in the bulk infrastructure. If you look at the performance then of the SEZs, if we start then on page 5 of 11, Kuha, SEZ, that's our oldest one, it is 6 billion of investment. The number of companies are listed there, in automotive, 12, 10 in logistics, agro-processing, BPOs, and so on, 7,900 jobs, and as you know, indirectly, that is 24,000 jobs in that zone. East London is also quite far advanced because they've been invested in the infrastructure. Richards Bay have just completed their infrastructure and so on. So in total, what we're looking at is there are 84 investors that we've attracted, 9 billion rand and 13,000 jobs, and indirectly that leads to 52,000 indirect jobs and so on. But so what we are saying is these zones, we are trying to get to 10, and for every province to have a special economic zone. There was a big question about why are we saying every province must have one. Is it sort of, there's no strict criteria, it's just sort of everybody gets a chance for one. It's no, what we did was when we revamped the Special Economic Zones Act, the MINMEC developed a set of criteria for what a zone must be. And they set the criteria very firm. It must be economically viable is the number one criteria before you comply for a zone. Secondly, you must do a feasibility study. And then you must assess its economic viability, and then you apply to the Special Economic Zones Board in order to be approved, and then it goes to the Minister and to Cabinet. So there is a rigorous process for assessment, and that is why it takes so long, but you have to go through a rigorous stage of planning and assessment, and then it is approved. And as I said, what was then agreed out, there was 22 proposed zones from the different provinces. We settled on 10 as a MINMEC. And as I said, and it settled on at least one per province. And that is because, as you know, certain provinces were completely excluded from our economy. There was zero investment in these areas. If you take Musina, if you take Malutia, Pafong, especially those located close to townships. And we needed to revive economic activity in those areas, and therefore, but as I said, on the criteria of economic viability. The other question related to the ratio of staff costs and operational costs and infrastructure costs. The deal that we've made on with the provinces with regards to special economic zones, we said that at the national level, we will mainly be involved in the question of infrastructure investment, and secondly, investment in the actual companies, in the factories. We will build the top structure for these companies. If they set up an investment, we will assist with the top structure. The province will be responsible for operational expenses. So this is, and the reason is very simple, is because only at the provincial level can you monitor the SEZ operator and the staff. So the, as you know, these the boards of the provincial of the SEZ is appointed by the MEC for Economic Affairs. And they then also, it is registered as a provincial entity. It is a provincial business entity, which means then it is accountable to the provincial legislature and to the provincial treasury. And therefore, the monitoring can only take place at that level. So therefore, operational costs of the zone is done with a provincial level. What we've built in is we've built the inbuilt incentive system from national level. We've said that we work on a first-come, first-served basis. So if you find an investor for your zone, they get to the front of the queue with regards to spending from the SEZ fund. And that has changed the dynamic, and as you can see, that's why there's 84 investors, and it has more than doubled over the past 2-3 years. And the reason is that if you bring the investor, you sign them up, we then assist with providing the incentive package for that investor, and so on. So, Chair, that is the issue of the SEZ and its benefit. We explained in some detail some of the ones where there has been slow progress. As you know, at national level, our role is to sort of sometimes cajole, sometimes to push provinces to take these matters of zone seriously. As you see, there was a big delay in Gauteng IDZ. We've pushed that along. There was delays in Atlantis SEZ. We pushed that along. We're trying to push Northern Cape. We've pushed Northwest. The reason what we do is for the first 3 years, National provides the operational costs only for the first 3 years. That is just to get started so that people can do the feasibility studies. They can employ some staff to get the SEZ going. But so we handle, as I said, startup costs. But then after the 3 years, it must go over to the province to handle the operational cost. And you can see the logic of why we do that is to get ownership, because we will be managing the entire 10 SEZ. And just to report, a full delegation of all our zones regularly now. They went last year, they're going again to visit China to attract investment into the zone. So we present one package as a country now, South Africa Inc., and we take all the 8 zones. Their CEOs are in the delegation and they present the investment opportunities in the country. And I'll try to conclude then, industrial parks. We said, we are constantly trying to drive the transformation agenda. And these township industrial parks is another innovation that we have spearheaded, again, with no extra money, but we are trying to revitalize. Then we've done now about 13 industrial parks that we have completed the first phase, at least in all of them. These are your Babalehis, your Bulindlelas, your Botsabalos, your Isitebes, and so on. So we see that this is the growth engine for our economy, because as you can see in all of these industrial parks, there is no shortage of companies that want to locate in those zones. It's just the quality of the infrastructure that we have that will attract them. And then there was questions around the gambling board and the national lotteries board, and we've answered that again. As you know, we had complaints mainly around conflict of interest, but mainly around just no effective management of gambling. Minister, after the report, we've removed the board, and it is under administration, and it has been turned around. It received a clean audit. After we put it under administration, and what we want to do is what we did with the National Regulator of Compulsory Specifications. We believe bodies like this don't need boards. They are not they're not financial institutions. We need people to exercise their fiduciary duties. They are like a department. They are regulators, and they fall under the PFMA. They are audited by the Auditor General. So we just need a regulator. And as you know, the gambling legislation is proposing that we have a national gambling regulator, like we have a CIPC commissioner or NRCS CEO, but you have no board. So that is the future of the gambling board. The question of, as I said, where there's criminal activity, those things are done. But in this case, most of the issues related to conflict of interest, and as I said, the minister removed the board. They did challenge him in court and to challenge their removal, but the court properly upheld the minister's decision to remove the board. And as I said, the institution is now properly functional and so on. And then, as I said, with regards to the question around the Lotteries Commission, there was no summoning of the National Lotteries Commission. Honourable Chair, those were the pertinent and major issues raised, and as I said, we've addressed them in detail in the letter itself, but I've just tried to give a short summary.
Thank you. Members, we're going to engage on these answers to questions that we asked previously, and if we can try not to go back to the initial report that was given to us and just engage on these answers that the DTI presented today. Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you very much. I seem not to be able to get a straight up and down answer on the forensic report that was used to put the gambling board into administration. It detailed maladministration, corruption, and many other issues. And I can't get a straight answer on, of those people named in that report, how many have actually been charged or arrested? And this is now 4 years down the line. Can you please give me an answer on that, DG? You made an interesting comment when you said there is no shortage of companies that want to relocate to these parks, and by that you're talking about the industrial parks. I would love to get that list of those companies, please. And what I've also never been able to get an answer to is what concessions are being made by local municipalities and provincial governments, because there has to be. Infrastructure is not enough to attract a business into an area that is quite distant from a national road or a port or an airport. And I mean, we all know why those parks were started out or how they started out. They were started out in some form of it was a labour rebate that was given to those companies. So I would still like to know and still ask and will keep asking, where's the business plan for these parks? I've asked repeatedly that there must be a business plan. You can't spend a quarter of a billion rand without a business plan just to put up nice fences and to make the verges look good. There's got to be a sound business plan that backs this investment up with new entrants into these business parks, not Whirlpool, who are already in Isitebi. I would like to know who those that no shortage of new companies, and also how far are you with the negotiations or discussions with local and provincial governments for some form of rebates, whether it is utilities or municipal rates, that sort of thing, because that's what will make industrial parks attractive. Thank you.
Are there other members who want to
speak? One chair. I just wanted to take the status of the Makado, Mofina, and also the Nkomazi. How far are we and where are we currently? Thank you.
Thank you. Back to you, DTI.
Honourable Chair, thank you. Honourable MacPherson, the first one is, as I indicated, with regards to the gambling board. As you know, I think the gambling board is presented to you and to the committee. But as I said, from the national side, after the whistleblower came to us, we did a forensic and they indicated serious weaknesses with regards to the administration. It is that when National decided to remove the board and to second administrators and to take over and to bring the gambling board to a proper running. So we've done that. The gambling board itself is an entity. It has a audit committee. It is audited. It has tabled all those reports. And as I indicated, they've received a clean audit. So the audit committee has fully implemented all the audit reports that it has done. From our side, as I said, when we got it, the issue was they indicated that the place is now not being managed properly. There's a maladministration, board members are in a conflict of interest, and they are not managing for fiduciary duties. There was, as far as I am aware, there was no criminal allegation. There was no allegation, for example, of direct fraud. There was issues of conflict of interest. So as I said, what we do in those cases, the minister refers that report to the audit committee in the entity. And they must, as I said, they must fully go into those audit queries and monitor it. And I think they have done so because the institution is completely turned around now. It's functioning effectively, and it has done that. On the question of industrial parks, Honourable McPherson, as you correctly say, all of these parks are owned by the municipalities or by the development corporations. So they are the owners of these assets. Our intervention was simply to say that all of these industrial parks which are located next to townships, the quality of the infrastructure does, if you look at any other part of the country, if you look at Epping here, Industria, if you look at the Milnerton Industrial Park, if you look at anything, if you look at in Centurion or in the Midrand, all of them have basic proper infrastructure. It is only in the black areas that there is no infrastructure. There has been absolute neglect, and these people have been, it is a false economy because it is a way for the market, as I said, Botsabello. If you want to have a proper industrial park, the industrial park should be in Mangaung. That's where the people are. But this industrial park is 60 kilometers from the market. So companies must spend the extra 60 kilometers of transport to transfer their goods to the market. It's because of apartheid imposition. So that is why, so all we are asking is, we are persuading the provinces, because it's their property, it is the provincial properties, we are asking them, please, if you want to run a modern industrial economy, you must have a basic level of infrastructure. So that is the basic business plan. Have a proper road, have a proper electricity connection. In Vulindlela and Mthatha, all the roads are gravel roads. So even just to get to a company, and all the companies are black companies there, to get to them, your car is damaged by just getting to the plant. So all we're telling Vulindlela is the municipality, the province, and what we do to incentivize them, we say we are putting in 10 million rand. Can you please come in as well so that we build roads in this industrial park? So that is the essential thing. So I don't think you need big feasibility studies just to bring the black industrial parks to the level of normal South African industrial parks. That is the aim of these issues. Because as we said with BEE, the reason our economy is underperforming, because where the 90% of the entrepreneurs are, they are excluded from the market. They are excluded to basic infrastructure. So in Vulindlela, as I said, the park is full of factories, but they don't have a basic road. So this program, so as I said, you're right, we have now convened a meeting of all the provinces. We've created an association of industrial parks, so that we can do precisely like that. So we can tell the municipality, you must offer these incentives. Don't charge expensive rentals, because many of them are using just as a sort of rentals. So we're telling them, please, you're supposed to offer cheap rentals. But as I said, they are the owners of it. They are the ones who are the landlords of it. We are playing a catalytic role as a department to A, prioritize this area because this should be a priority area for investment. We shouldn't actually invest in the other areas. We should give priority to these ones because of 40, 50 years of neglect. So that is the purpose of these parks, and that's why we're saying it's an absolutely essential program. As I said, the names of the company, that is what we are resourcing. We're saying every company, like we manage the SEZs, we're saying there must be a proper board, there must be a proper management of your industrial park so that you can count the tenants in it. The problem is the municipalities they don't even know how many companies is in there. But as I said, they haven't been there for years. They've neglected these parks. So that is what we're trying to do. Stenica here, we've now created a formal institution. Like we've done with SEZs, we created legislation. We want to also now in this area create legislation for township industrial parks so that they are properly managed, properly resourced, and properly thinking. But the only thing we're emphasizing is here, we can't wait till that legislation happens. We're doing, at least we want proper roads, we want proper lighting, proper security as a first phase. And then what we will do is we will start working on the actual companies where we help them to build their top structure. As I said, in some of these things, there are world-class companies. Nestle is expanding its plant in Babalehi. So here you have one of the world's number one companies, Nestle, is in a township industrial park. And if you can't, and as I said, there's gravel roads now from a multinational company. And that's why we're saying it's basic things like infrastructure we just need to do. And we will take over the function from the province or from the municipality just to kick-start it. But it's really start-up funding because, as I said, we're not getting any extra money for this. So we're trying to use our money to stimulate, well, National Treasury to give us more money, but also to get the provinces to allocate more resources to this area. Musina and Kumasi is very far. I think they've just approved it, or it's before the committee for Mpumalanga's special economic zone, so there's good news on that front. And so, and then on Musina, the colleagues, that's why Sipho Zikode is not here, they are in China to address this matter. As you know, one of the investors or one of the person that has been active in has appeared on the list of Interpol, therefore the minister then has given notice that he will withdraw the license unless they give us a proper due diligence explanation and so on. But in the meanwhile, what we are doing is we are looking for other investors we are visiting some of the SOEs in China, and that's why SIPO is there already, to get this zone going and to get the first phase of this zone going. Thanks.
Thank you. Honourable McPherson.
So, I just want to confirm that as far as you're aware, no one has been criminally charged or arrested emanating from that forensic report into the former gambling board. And then, DG, no one disagrees that, and I've actually been to, I think I've been to 80% of the industrial parks. I've been to the one in Mthatha. It's the only place where I've seen a funeral parlor, a tuck shop, and then a bed shop right next door to each other. And so I'm not sure exactly what is also going on in those parks as well. I think that there's a lot of non-industrial activity that is taking place in those parks just because they have been left to do whatever they want. And when I talk about a business plan, if I was you, if I was the department, I would have been saying to the provinces, we want to invest in these, we want to bring them up to standard, but these are the things that you should be doing in order for us to invest. You should ensure that there are incentives for people to attract new businesses. You should ensure that there are management associations for these X, Y, and Z. Because let me use Isithebe as an example. Isithebe want to charge market-related rentals in the industrial park. What's the point? Why would you want to charge market-related rentals in an industrial park that is 80 k's or 100 k's from Richards Bay. I mean, that's the whole point of being in there, is that you can get a discount in those parks, and you know, that's the incentive to be there. But they do whatever they want. In fact, it's more expensive to buy water in Esetebi than it is in Richards Bay. That doesn't make sense, that they are charging customers exorbitant prices like that. And so that's what I talk about when I mention a business plan. How does it roll out? How do people actually get there? How do you get those new entrants there? And that's why roads and fences and lighting is nice, but it's not enough to give a new entrant a real desire to come and invest there. And that's what we should be looking at. How do we take those black startup businesses that want to go and invest in an industrial park? What is the incentive for them to be there? Lighting and fencing is one component of it, but it's not going to be the kickstart that they need. They need incentives, they need rebates off of municipal services or rentals to actually go and invest there. And I do hope that at some point you will actually get to that place, because we need to ensure that there is value, that there is return for the 250 million rand that we're investing there.
DG?
Yes, no, I think, as I said, we do actually, we've come to the committee where we presented the business plan and the plan. As you know, we started this project 2-3 years ago. We had phase one, phase two, we took you through East Park. We work with the Development Bank of South Africa. Before we start anything, there's a diagnostic done. What are the key problems in the park? Is it fencing? Is it security? Is it roads? That diagnostic is done. Then we identify the main issues. That is done. That constitutes phase one. We've completed phase one. As I said, industrial parks differ. If you take Esetebi is probably the most developed industrial park. It is close to world class, and it's close to our special economic zones in terms of the quality of the infrastructure. But as I said, that is and so as I said, we have raised it with them. We've told them what are the purpose of these things. But as I said, they say they want to be market related and so on. But if you go to another park, as I said, if you go to Bonilela, you go to Babalehi, you go to Botswello, you get not even a tarred road. Now tell me what investor can live in a place that doesn't have a tarred road. So there it is quite basic, and what we've done in phase one, and also, as you know, the criminal elements have taken over. There's no fencing, so there's no protection for an investor. As soon as he puts up anything, it gets stolen. So the first thing you must do there is put up a fence. So these things are very basic, and that's why I don't understand why we need to make a big... we presented our plans and so on. As I said, the main thing which is agreed is that we must lock in, and I think Honorable McPherson agrees, the provinces, we are trying to make them part of this issue. It is their parks, and that's why we, at the last conference we had about 3-4 months ago, we've agreed them, they all agreed to sign up to a formal association. Then we will work together to develop plans for these parks like we do with the SEZ. We will work out the division of labor, we will work out who takes operational control, who takes this, and so on. But as I said, we hope to move this into a formal area where we have legislation. And but also what we really need from the committee is that we need, like we have with the special economic zones, we need significant resources to drive these parks. And it's an investment in underinvested areas. And if you're going to transform the country, you must transform the township economy. So what we think we should focus on is to drive more resources and then a legislative framework and a reporting framework, so that all of them need to offer a basic set of incentives and so on.
Thank you very much, DG, and thank you for your input on this matter. Members, I just want to announce that our next meeting is on Tuesday the 24th in V227, starting at 0900. And with that, I'd like to...
We accept the answer.
yes, we accept their responses, and I'd like to now adjourn this meeting. Thank you very much.
I swear to you.
No, he's got it on his watch. His watch, it looks like it.